Hey, everybody, and welcome to PodQuest. We have a special episode this week where I'm going to be talking with illustrator Jason Lennox. Jason?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Chris. Always a pleasure to come on your show, and always a pleasure to hang out with you and your wife, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we've known each other a couple of years now. Haven't seen you at all in a year, at least because the world, which we were talking about before. But we were going to talk about the Kickstarter that I believe it launches Saturday, right?
Saturday, January 23rd. Very excited. It's the fourth issue of Lords of the Cosmos, which doing a little self-published book to hit a fourth issue feels like a huge milestone. So it's very exciting.
Now, where, like, if you had to like place this in like the full width of like the story that you and your team kind of have planned, like, where would this issue fall in kind of like the timeline of it? Like, is this like the middle point? Are we getting close to the end? Do you have 20 more issues planned?
So the story that has been the main story since issue one, I think it's going to go three more issues. So I think that storyline will wrap with issue seven. One of the fun things about Lords of the Cosmos, and it was done on purpose, was to create a modular book. So we can add in different artists and different writers and different creative people with as little or as much as they want to do. And I could see it going after seven issues because it's an anthology format that's been that way since day one. So we can always mix it up to whatever stories want to be told, and we can make the issues bigger or smaller and have different creatives involved as needed, which, again, now it becomes very modular. So I think the main story will wrap in seven issues, which we're working on issue five as we speak. But I think if we keep enjoying it and enjoy having more, you know, people involved, it can keep going for quite some time past that.
Which is always awesome. Like, knowing that something you made kind of has that like life of its own almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not saying that we had some huge plan, but it was kind of a general plan when we started, is that all of us have other things we're doing. And even though we really wanted to keep this thing going as much as we could, it was like, if it was just, you have to do all the writing, you have to do all the art, between Jason and Dennis and I don't think we would have kept it going. But because we could bring in other people, you know, we looked at it as, you know, the more diversity and people, the stronger the book got. Not, well, this person isn't exactly like me, so they can't work on this project. So we've embraced everyone's differences. We've embraced everyone's different strength, and we've embraced the book being really diverse visually, diverse from writing styles. But we, as editors, we try to keep it to a general point on brand. But other than that, we kind of let it go free. So great question. Yeah. Lords of the Cosmos 4 will put you right down and about in the middle of a 7-part story,
which is awesome. And like you were saying, like with it being kind of like modular, like you have that main story, but then throughout it, like the, like every issue has all these like other stories that are focusing on different parts of the universe. And I know you said that like everyone comes into it with like their different style, their different art, their different writing, but I feel like all of the art complements each other still too. Like, you're not getting such drastically different styles that you don't know it's still part of like the same book, if that makes sense.
So a lot of the artists that have come on are at first were people I was friends with, and then I started reaching out to people I was fans of and saying, I really like what you do. Could you be on the book? And some people have said yes, and some people have said no. But basically, it's kind of a big wish list of like, oh, the people that are in the book, they're people that I really think are awesome. So I don't know, maybe it's you're seeing things through whatever my visual quality filter is to say, I really like this artist, check it out. So I think that could be the common theme, is that it's stuff that I like, and it's stuff that seems to fit kind of our science fiction, action, fantasy, 80s vibe. So I think perhaps as the art overseer, that's what you're picking up on. Which if you are, that's great, because it means we've done a good job of putting the right people doing this work together.
Yeah, I definitely think that's what it is. Because like everyone, like I'm actually just scrolling through the preview or the draft of the Kickstarter, and just like looking at some of like the pages for like the different stories. Like every one of them is. Yeah, every one of them is different. Like, I mean, just you can just look at the faces of the characters and see that some like a different person drew each of them. Mm-hmm. But like, I like the overall just feel of it. Like, it all feels like it's from the same book and the same universe.
Well, it's funny because you get enough talented people that are smarter than you, and they start to give you good ideas. So between issues two and three, Dave Newbold, who's a good friend of mine, and he lives in Virginia, and I see him at shows when we had shows. He's done a bunch of short stories for the book for us in issue 3. He did the Bug with a Shotgun story.
Okay.
One of the things he questioned us about before issue 3 was, he said, you don't have a character Bible. And I was like, what do you mean? Because you know those things where it says, like, this person is so tall and their armor's blue, you know, and basically you want to know how tall, how big, are they, you know, fat, skinny, short, tall, you know, green, yellow, you know, black, red, what, you know what I mean? Just so there's some standard that you can say, okay, dude, here's this guy, here's what they are. And we actually hired an artist, and we actually had all the main characters scaled out, drawn out, colored with their names. So we could send that to people and say, this guy is too tall, and he has, you know, burnt skin, and he has this armor, whatever.
Oh, that's really smart.
Right? And, you know, at the time, I was like, do we really want to spend money on this? But I'm going to tell you what, it's like having a Swiss Army knife, because you can just say, here you go. And people can look at it and say, okay, great. Now I know that this guy is 25 feet tall, or this person is very fat or skinny or whatever they are. You can just send it to people, and I'm like, okay, I get why companies do this for their characters, because it is helpful. Because his question was, he couldn't tell how big Bug with a Shotgun was. He said, is this guy a giant? Is he little? And I was like, well, he's this big. And he's like, how am I supposed to know that? I was like, yeah. Dude, you're smart, man. You got a great point. We can't tell. We don't
know. And you know what? Even there, like, you could even run into the issue, like, with a bug with a shotgun, like, different people are going to have, like, different concepts of a bug at that point. Like, right. One person might draw a cockroach. One person might draw a dragonfly. Like,
right. So having that, actually, I felt really helped us to have a standard to say, this is what it is. Right. The book's black and white, so the color standards don't come up that much yet. But that was a really smart move, and it helps just to build the property to say, hey, you want to draw stuff? Here's the character standards. You know, Aegis is the main hero. He's 6'4". This is what his armor looks like. This is his weapon. And if we do color, this is his basic color scheme. And now we have, and even how do you spell his name?
Yeah, you know what? Even with the color, like, when it comes to just black and white and shading, like, knowing what color pattern someone's supposed to be, I'm no artist, so I could be completely wrong here, but I feel like knowing if something's supposed to be blue versus, you know,
sure,
orange, it's going to change, like, how you shade that in and color it, or not color it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what level of black you put on the something, basically.
So, yeah, no, and I think the more issues we've had, so to be able to come to an artist and say, hey, here's 3 or 4 PDFs of comic, here is a color standard sheet of all these creatures and characters, it starts to help push the visual towards where, it, you know, the house flavor or the house style to say, this is Lords of the Cosmos. This is what it looks like. This is what it is. And someone may say, I don't like that. And you'd say, okay, you know what? Then it isn't for you, because this is the flavor. I mean, you know, it'd be like going to a Chinese restaurant and saying, I don't like anything here. It's like, well, maybe you don't like Chinese.
Exactly.
Maybe you're a hot wings guy. I don't know. But like,
no hard feelings.
Yeah, no hard feelings. But this is what it is. Like, it's going to have these spices, these kinds of ingredients. This is what it is. And yeah, I mean, I think that's really cool that you picked up on that. You're like, this is a coherent visual style. And I think we've had, I think, probably close to, I don't know, 20 to 30 artists work on the books now, to some capacity or another, maybe more than that. But it's been a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, which is awesome. Because like you were saying before, that's going to help the longevity of it past, like, that main story.
Oh, yeah, because here's the thing. The less people you depend on, the more critical it is. That what happens if someone has a problem and or gets bored or has to move on or they can't work anymore? It's like just dead ends.
Yeah. Like, if you had somebody lined up for issue 4 that, you know, fell off for some reason, like they got a different gig that they couldn't pass up, like any number of things. At least you have people from the last 3 issues where you could be like, hey, would you be interested in doing a backup story or something?
Well, and I'll be honest, Chris, there's an embarrassment of talent wealth out there.
Just incredibly, you know, go look at Instagram or Twitter for a minute, and there's so much talent on those things that it's, for me as an artist, sometimes it's just humbling to go even and just kind of browse around, because you're like, oh my goodness, there's so many talented people out there. And let's talk about issue 4. So Sasha is an artist from Italy that I just saw things he was doing on Facebook and Instagram. The guy is an insane talent, and we just reached out and said, would you want to work on the book with us? And he was very upbeat, and we gave him the script for Hunger. which came out of an online writing session that we had to try to add a little bit of meat to the main story to kind of have an additional subplot into it with some of the villains fighting each other. And we gave him this kind of, you know, bill of fare of it's Lords of the Cosmos get involved with Saving Private Ryan, beach landing with like zombies and robots and this Greek god hero showing up. And then it goes from there to an origin story for this cannibalistic cyborg that is in the main story and has an axe to grind with our unicorn villain that we've seen in the first three issues. And he knocked it out of the park. I mean, the guy's a high-end professional operator, and he's sending us pages, and every single page is just amazing, amazing, amazing. So, I mean, obviously there's a sample page for Hunger where you see a turtle battleship shelling the beach, and some of the villains are, you know, commenting on how bad that is that this thing has shown up to shoot at them. But, you know,
Sasha, yeah, I'm actually looking at that page right now, and
yeah,
it's nuts. Like, between the alligator, like the steampunk alligator looking things.
Yeah, the troop transports, right?
Yeah. And then the giant turtle with a cannon on its back.
Yeah, no, and then even that, there's a
concept artist, Alex J, that's on Instagram now, was on Twitter. And Alex J does these insane concept art, and I reached out to Alex J and said, hey, you know, you do a lot of really wild stuff. Can I hire you to do concept art? And you can see it on there, Chris, is that beach landing cover. And Alex J ended up making, literally, it looked like a movie poster to me, of like those hero characters running out of those crocodiles onto the beach.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, that to me, that one illustration, I was like, that's what I want Lords of the Cosmos to be. You know, if it was a one sheet movie poster, like, that's what it's all about. It's stuff you sort of recognize, but you're like, this is really foreign to me, and it's really exciting, and I want to know what they're doing and what's going to happen next.
Which, I mean, I think for anyone that, and in case anyone's wondering, if you want to find the link for the Kickstarter, I'm going to include it in the notes of the show. And on Saturday, I'll make sure it goes out on like all of our social media stuff that I'll ramble at the end of the show. But I think anyone that like stumbles on this, like on Kickstarter, just like scrolling through the art, like they're going to get that. Cause like every image that like you have up here, it's different. It's showing like a different part of the story, obviously, cause it's from each of the different stories.
Right.
But it's kind of got like a different feel depending on maybe what one person is into versus the other.
Yeah. So this issue is going to have four stories. So my main story continues this kind of slower moving introduction of the world and the characters where the heroes start to get engaged and you realize that the main hero has gone into hiding, and we start to reveal things from a prior war where his brother was executed by the main villain Umex, and we reveal that he has a superpowered talking sword that is his weapon of mass destruction that he keeps buried a mile underground in a vault. And then in the main story, we see the villains are marching across the planet to the capital city of the world, Gemspire, and they're putting it under siege. And we start to lay the roots for issue 5, where the villains have the city communications jammed. And the main villain says, shut off the jamming. And then his henchmen are like, well, if we do that, won't the heroes show up? And he's like, exactly. Right. So that's kind of our like, oh, my moment, right, in the main story. And then we have a really cool origin story by Zach Bruner for this talking sword, that the main hero has this intelligent sword that seems to be a pretty important part of the book. So we go into the last several thousand years of the sword, where the sword narrates its own creation from metal ore into now that it's locked into a bank vault underground, basically. And then we have the origin story for the heroes, Techno Wizard and the Talking Cat, who maintain their secret fortress on top of a mountain, and how they got to where they're at, the last of my kind, where the wizard and the cat are the last of the talking cats and the last of the techno wizards. And then we have Hunger, which is the, you know, origin story for I'm drawing a blank on my own character, but
I was gonna say you have too many characters to keep them all straight.
Right,
up.
No, there's like 40 some. It's for the one who's a gigantic, he's almost like the size of a tank, with big metallic legs and a human body crafted under this acid tank where he has to eat other people to survive. So he's basically like a cybernetic cannibal. But yeah,
one that's on like the Kickstarter like video.
Yes. Yeah. He's at the end, right? He's at the end. He's the big reveal, right? And his toy, because we have toy packaging in the back cover, and I think the toy packaging is in the Kickstarter. You can see him as he was a 1980s toy and packaging. Because we had
I saw that on here. I'm trying to find it again. There's a lot of art to scroll through on the page.
Even the 1980s cartoon poster, right? Because one of the guys designed Lords of the Cosmos if they were part of a 1980s cartoon lineup.
Yeah, actually, that's the one I was just on.
Yeah.
And yeah, the toy packaging is right after that.
Yeah, and now, boy, help me. What is the name of that character? I'm embarrassed. I should be rejected from my own book. My goodness.
Mordantix?
Mordantix, yeah. So Hunger is Mordantix's origin, but then he ties back into the sword because the sword has part of the reason he's a cyborg. And then he wants to kill Cyclorn in the main story because Cyclorn failed Umex in issue 3. So one of the things about these books is the more that we get to do, we're trying to do our best to tie the books in together to really have that old school Marvel 80s feel of like, see Avengers issue 12, see, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 142. And like, I think Marvel in their heyday when I was growing up, well, their comic book heyday, I think, now it's more of a movie heyday. I really loved how you could buy every Marvel book and they were all very interconnected. Like, read West Coast Avengers 12 on sale now. And like, it was really good at like kind of giving you the feel that the Marvel universe was this very interconnected series of comic books. And I think they're really trying to do that now with their movies, but the 80s comics were small enough you could get all of them and it all connected together. And
yeah, now
really
they put out 40 books a month, and that's hard to do.
It's hard. And so we've really tried to do that with our anthology format to really throw a lot of these, like, see issue, you know, see this story. And we put the little two asterisks and stuff. And we've got enough stories now that we can start to, like, interrelate it back in. So at the beginning of Hunger, the Lords of the Cosmos have a hero riding a water creature. He's like their water general. We have a thing like, see, you know, the Night Sea story from issue 1. So just to try to keep rewarding the reader more for like, oh, wait. You know what I mean? Like, they're calling back to their first issue because we've done enough issues that we can actually start to play around with that a little bit.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in, like, the first two issues, you had callbacks to, like, basically fake stuff, right? Like,
yes.
It wasn't fake. Like, it was part of the history of that universe, but
right,
it didn't exist in any medium.
Right. It was kind of like we thought it was fun, and then we've actually tried to do it more for real. And who knows, maybe we'll do callbacks for the things that we just made up in the first issue. I mean, because part of it was we always said, what if Lords of the Cosmos was like Masters of the Universe, right? Which was always kind of the initial concept to kind of do our riff on what He-Man, you know, what we thought it should have been, right? Is to say, okay, every issue's had a toy in the back cover, right? And now in this issue, we're going to have, you know, a TV cartoon ad. You know, we have the little animated trailers, you know, that go on the Kickstarter, which everyone will see when it launches on Saturday. And I hope you thought it was pretty cool. That's why we delayed it to get more time to put that just where we want. I thought it turned out great. You know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But that we keep trying to add more stuff because it's like, what would these commercial properties have had? They would have had cartoons. They would have had toys. They would have had comic books, you know, to really try to like, give you the feeling when you're reading this that there was an entire brand. And we know it didn't, but it's like we want to try to give you that feeling that you're stepping into an iconic brand because it has all these things that those brands had. And there's like a checklist.
Yeah, it's supposed to feel like it's 1985 all of a sudden.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe we'll have someone do like an animation cell for one of these things, or maybe we'll do like some cosplay and like shoot up a live action movie poster for the live action version of the movie that didn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a level of fun kind of having that kind of interplay to keep kind of giving the fans another wrinkle to say, oh, yeah, like this time it was a Saturday morning cartoons. And it was funny when Joe Freistuhler did that. He even made up other shows. There's like a worm thing that's kind of rip off of the Smurfs.
Yeah. Like it was like, I think it said Blurfs. Yeah, the worm.
You know, yeah. I mean, like, and that stuff to me is so fun because it's like we're trying to give you that experience, but with a kick-ass comic. You know, because I don't think, I mean, as much fun as we have with kind of the silly stuff, and one of the things, another thing, we're going to have a letters page in this issue. We're going to have the Ugly Studios bullpen, right? I like all that, but I feel we're giving you a kick-ass, you know, grade-A quality comic with really good writing and really good art. Like, it's something that it's like, no, this is a professional book. It's well done, well printed, there's talent involved, and there's a lot of thought and care put into giving you a first-rate, first-package book, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I have the first three issues that exist.
Yeah.
And I remember, so I forget if I forget when I got them from you. I forget if it was at Keystone, I think it would have been that first Keystone they did, the one where the artist alley was just those two tiny rows next to the wrestling stage.
Yes.
I forget because I bought a I bought like three or four prints from you for my wife, actually.
Yes.
And then I forget if I picked up the book then or if I ended up getting it from you, I think at Baltimore that year. Okay. So I remember you telling my wife the story and me walking away being like, I don't want to know. And she's like, well, I want to know. So I like left for 10 minutes while you like filled her in on it. But, yeah. But I remember like reading those two issues and then whether it was at Keystone and then seeing you like at Baltimore, like a few weeks later or just at Baltimore reading them, mm-hmm. And like coming up to you and being like, all this stuff is so interconnected. And this was a really long way to get to this point. I apologize.
That's okay.
Like all the characters are like, they're fleshed out without actually having time to be fleshed out. Like you're throwing all those little nods to things where it's like, hey, this character's been around since issue X. Like that doesn't exist, but like we're telling you it does. So this character has a history that they didn't just spring into life all of a sudden.
Well, thing about Star Wars, which, you know, I'm 45, so I grew up with it. And I remember as a kid, you saw those original three films. My father and I, we talked on and off for years trying to figure out what was the Clone Wars. And I remember my dad, and this might have been like when I was like 10 or 12 and like 85, 86, 87. He said, well, Jason, it's obvious that Obi-Wan was like a letter number designation. And Obi-Wan was Obi-Wan Kenobi's like clone number in the Clone Wars, son. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I mean, if you go back and watch those films, it's just like throwaway lines. You're like, oh, yeah, you know, we were in a clone war, you know. And then obviously they put a ton of effort into trying to show us every bit of minutia with these things. And I'll be honest, I still think back to enjoying it more when all it was a couple things like, yep, Clone Wars. Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think everything needs this in-depth explanation of everything. I do think a lot of this stuff worked better. Look at Indiana Jones, like the original Raiders. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in that that are just like, they explain Marion and Indy's relationship in like a handful of sentences and some body language.
Yeah. And I mean, you're speaking my language with these movies now, too. Like, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like, we know that they had a relationship and it ended poorly and Indy was older and she's angry. We don't need to see it. Like it's, yeah. It's so effective. It's like, okay, you explain it in a minute.
Yeah. And that's why like with the way that with the way that those first few issues were storytelling, you weren't, it wasn't like exposition dump after exposition dump. You're kind of letting the reader figure out the characters and what was going on just through what was happening. And you were doing these callbacks that were like, they're basically just there to like let people know like, yeah, things happened before this story. Like this is not the start of this world.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things that's going to happen in issue five is in issue one, there was like this big roll call pinups to the villains, kind of like a cartoon intro. That'll happen for the heroes in issue five. So it kind of bookends that like, okay, wait, they did that in issue one. Oh, okay. Now all the heroes kind of get their show and tell in issue five. So it all kind of comes together. Where the more these issues come out, the more it'll start to kind of make sense with, oh yeah, I understand why they did that now, you know. But I'm a big believer in less is more.
Now, did you guys go into this and have the whole story arc?
That's a great question. So we always had a general concept and a general idea of the ending, right? And I'm not going to spoil the ending. I know I told your wife, but we'll
I appreciate that
secrecy. But it was kind of we always had kind of a general idea in the ending. We had I felt a pretty good ending, and it's still the ending we have in mind. And then it was kind of like, okay, so we have kind of this general idea and an ending. And then we started kind of taking a couple steps into what it was. And then we've been working on it now for 6.5 or 7 years. And there's just been so much more that has spun out of it where it's just, it's a big sandbox that we keep exploring. And the more we explore, the more nooks and crannies and things that we keep finding that we want to explore. And part of it's just been one of the original parts of this was saying, if we had to design these characters, who were they? And the very first thing that I made was like 7 villain pinups and 6 hero pinups based off of just a description of here's this character, basically what they are. And I just started drawing characters. And that was the very first thing we made. And then we basically had 13 pages of just images of these heroes in like little groups, like groups of 4 and 5 or 3. And that was the first thing we had. And then we just started drawing back and forth about what were these heroes going to do? And then I started building pages around what these pinups would be introducing and moving on to. So those were always the basic chunks. And then we started moving forward with those, with that as the main story. And then at that time is when we said, we need more people to flesh this out because I don't have time to do all this stuff. I'll never get it done. Right. And nothing yeah. more disappointing than I'm going to do this and then it never happens. Right. So if you got a construction job and you got to hang up, you know, 500 pieces of sheetrock and you want it done quick, do you A, keep hoping the same guy works faster, or B, bring in more guys? You bring in more guys because then it's like, wow, we got five guys doing it. And before it was just one guy doing it. And now, hey, we're moving. And we, you know, and if the main guy needs a break, everyone else can keep on working. And
exactly.
And that gave us the freedom to start executing ideas and writing new stories and like throwing more things out there and bringing in little micro teams and saying, could you draw 5 pages? Could you draw 6 pages? Could you draw 7 pages? Could you write 5 pages? And when you give people little micro bites to, oh yeah, I could do that. You start saying, hey, could you draw 300 pages for us? It's like, that's a lot. Yeah, you know, that's a if you say, could you draw 5? Could you draw 6? They're like bites.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And they'll, as far as the characters go, have you created every character, or have any of the artists that you brought on like pitched a character for a story?
So there's the original heroes and villains, which were all to some degree made up by three of us. It's the three of us that created it, known it, me and Dennis Fallon and Jason Balmateer. I'll be honest, some of them might have been more me, some of them might have been more Dennis, some of them might have been more Palm. But those original characters, the ones that are in that character Bible lineup sheet, those are the ones that are kind of they're the brand characters. We've had characters that were described for some of the offshoot stories, and artists have designed them for us. So in issue 2, in the story Nights Out, we introduce a team of kind of a She-Ra type team of kind of the, like if there was a, you know, young girls doll 80s line, like those characters show up as a past thing and they all get killed except two of them that are part of the current incarnation of the characters. One's a villain, one's a hero. And so Danny is a friend of mine that does a lot of coloring for me, and she does all the cover layouts for my covers on these books. We gave her the task to draw that story, and she did it. She did a great job. She's a professional. And we gave her the description for like the Rainbow Knights. Okay. And she made them all up. Right. I mean, it was just basically us saying, here's 6 names or 7 names. And she made them all up, like the two that are twins. One's kind of like the older queen. And she took those characters and totally made them up. And like, it fit. It worked, you know. But
awesome.
You know, so for those characters, the Rainbow Knights, that was, you know, kind of Dave and I gave them just kind of generic names. And Danny brought them to life. Right. So, I mean, like in that case, she was given, I would call it minimal direction. I think it was, here's their names. Think of them as kind of the She-Ra heroes. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And she knocked it out where you looked at them and said, oh, these characters look spot on. And then she even made up a bunch of villains that got killed. Like, that again, like there was a woman with a snake head or snake features and forearms. And you're like, okay, that's totally Lords of the Cosmos. Like, just kind of like little throwaway characters that are kind of in the fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so we always try to keep those main characters front and center. And, you know, so Zack Snyder, not the director, but an actual guy named Zack Snyder that I met at Keystone when you guys were at that show, he ended up drawing the Orchomemnon story in issue 3. And Zack took our one character, because it was pretty much just one, and built his entire world based off of our story and designed Plant City, their plant bodies, the cactus soldiers, the spore-borne enemies. He literally designed the entire culture that this character came from in the past before he got put into a robot body. And it was amazing. It was like we were getting these pages from him, and it was like, this is so, like, we gave him, it was the equivalent of giving a guy a bone, like an archaeologist, and they build a whole freaking skeleton, and you're like, oh, like that thing is the T-Rex from another. You know, and to me, that was the magic of stuff like this. Like, Zach's a young guy. He's a super artist. He's super creative. He's super smart. And we gave him a knuckle bone, and he built us a skeleton. That was a cooler skeleton than I could have imagined. And it all worked into the DNA of this one character. So Orchomemnon went from a character sheet to, like, he's, you know, a quarter million years old. He didn't do the right thing. And now he's trying to make amends. And now his body is stuck in a machine. And his only goal is to find a place to plant the seed future of his society. And blah, 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 blah. And it was great. And, like, he designed all this stuff. And obviously in that story, Orchomemnon gets torn in half. He's crippled. And we took him from this kind of, like, plant knight to, like, this kind of crunched over flower and, like, a mechanical snow globe with arms and legs.
Yeah, and I got... That's got to be really cool for, like, for both sides of it, too. Because, like you said, like, you'll give somebody just, like what your concept was. Like, whether it's a name and a brief description or, like a brief history. And then, like, getting to hand it to an artist and, like, the artist getting to design a character. And then you getting to see how somebody interpreted something that, like, maybe you had a different vision in your mind. But, like, they came up with something that was just as cool.
Well, as a create, and at this point, you know, when you look at these books, like, there's the main story that I draw, but then there's, like, the editorial hat you put on. So to see these other creatives take these nuggets and, like, build fully fleshed out worlds for these little individual characters, and part of Lords of the Cosmos, as we've done these issues, is that we're learning about the world by learning about each character. And some of the characters we still don't know much about. And, you know, over time, maybe we'll get to give every single one of those original 40 characters their spotlight, you know, where it's like, oh, now I know why they have a gigantic cyborg dragon, or, ooh, this thing that's just got tentacles and shoots sonic waves. Like, why is it here? You know, like, every single person, like, what's their story? What's their purpose? And I think it's an exploration of allowing the artists and the writers to examine that and then to give us that visual richness. And again, then for the reader to get to come along for that ride too. I mean, I've looked at Lords of the Cosmos 4 now for the better part of the last 9 months. It's like having a baby, right?
Oh, wow.
I'm so excited for people to see it. And I've seen it, like, nonstop, like rereading pages over and over and over. And I really think, and of course I'm biased, but I really think it's an awesome book, right? So I think for the reader, I think just when people get to the, and you're looking at the Kickstarter, most people haven't seen that. I wanted you to see it since we're doing this podcast. But I think for a lot of people, they're like, I haven't seen anything. I'm like, you will on Saturday. And I think you would agree. They're going to see stuff and be like, whoa, like this is a big shot to the head that you're giving me. And I think once you get the book and the book's like, you know, 40 internal pages plus front and back covers, you know, to me, my whole thing is I want to knock you on your socks where you're just like, holy crap, these guys, they gave me the real deal. They gave me a kick-ass, thick old book where every single page is like care consideration, where it's just like, boom, right in your face. You know, that's what I want to give the people. Plus, so, I mean, I'm impressed with the stuff I'm seeing. I can't, for the person that hasn't seen it at all, I'm excited to get those reactions, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that, and, like, that makes sense, because, like you said, like, you get to come at it from a bunch of different angles, too. Like, you get to come at it from, like, the creator angle, where, you know, that main story is yours. Like you drew that, yeah. you helped develop those characters, that story, that world, but then you also get to come at it from, like, the editor side, where, like, you help these other people bring these characters to life that, like, you had a hand in also.
Yeah, and then there's, like, kind of the behind the scenes stuff. So in the Hunger story, the page that we have up there with the turtle battleship is a big close-up. The reason that page exists was that was the last page that was made, and it originally didn't exist, but we ended up having so much exposition on the prior page that the letterer was having problems making it all make sense. And I said, you know, we didn't get a pinup of this turtle battleship. He's only in a couple panels. And I'm like, we don't really get a feel for how big he is in the book. And I'm like, plus this exposition it's so jammed on this prior page. We got to relieve it. So we had the artist, Sasha, make that one page to let the text breathe and give us like a 3/4 page pinup to show scale.
Which is awesome on both fronts, because, I mean, yeah. Anytime that you can get that text, like, space where you're not just cut, it's not just a wall of text on a page covering all the art, and then also get, like, a cool pinup out of it, like,
yes,
that's a win-win all the way around.
And again, it's like being a director where it's like, we're going to cut this scene, we're going to add this scene. So even Mordanix, he was a character that we loved the design for. And to this point in the book, he hasn't done much. He's been in a few panels, like destroying stuff in the background. And at one point we show him harvesting dead people in issue 2 in a war zone, but he doesn't really say anything or do anything outside of that. And so we kept saying we needed more drama in the main story. And we said, we really have to show these villains being villains, right? Fighters got to fight. Villains got to be villaining. So we kept saying, what can we show these villains doing that's evil, like really evil, but different. And Cycorn gets shot by Orchomemnon near the beginning of issue 3. And so Dennis said, well, he got shot and he was told to go do something and he failed. So wouldn't Umex be really angry at him? And then we said, but what if Umex isn't that mad at him, but another character has it out? And we said, which character would hate Cycorn, right? Who's kind of the sniveling Starscream flunky. And we all, and I think it was Jason said, well, how about Mordanix? He's so cool. And we actually, a fan had commissioned us to build a model and sell it to him. We actually had the action figure built for this guy.
Oh, that's really cool.
And then we started brainstorming, well, why would he hate Cycorn, right? And why would he want Cycorn to get killed? And then he could use Cycorn screwing up in the prior issue. So there's this whole thing now in the main story that I drew where, like, Mordanix and Cycorn are going at it, and Mordanix wants him dead, like, in the current time. And then Umex, you know, has to intercede. That's all I want to say. I don't want to spoil too much. And then we said, but we got to have another story in the book. And then that'll turn into Hunger with like this whole kind of like brainstorming odyssey of, well, how can we show, how did the guy get on the front of this robot body? And that's Hunger. And it was so much fun to put that together. And again, the reader's going to read it. But again, that's why I love doing, you know, things like this to talk about the process for people that are really into it is like, I can look at that book and say, this is how it started. And these are all like the little changes that happened to give you the book that you got. So like another like insider thing is like my friend Joe that did the Saturday morning cartoon ad, he originally was going to do the Orchomemnon story, right? For issue 3, his style, for whatever reason, it wasn't connecting with us. It just didn't work. And we had to make a decision to pull him off that story. But we said, you know what? We love your art. You've done other stuff in the book that we love. We were like, we want you on the book still to do something new. This story is just not the right fit, right? But we love you. We want you on the book. We said, what would you like to? Because he said, man, I can't get a feel for this plant city. It just wasn't right. And he said, let me write and draw my own story. I'll pick the characters. And he picked the talking cat and the old wizard man. And he designed this origin story that connected both of them. And like the art, when you see it in the book, and there's a sample page on there too from the story Last of My Kind, it just hits, man. It's so his style. He wrote the story. It worked. He pulled everything together, and it totally fits with Lords of the Cosmos. And he even showed us, he gave the wizard like a blown off foot. And then I incorporated that into the cover, like, because I did two covers, one with Mordanix and one with the cat and the old wizard, Tiedmus. And we worked the mechanical foot, and then I actually added.
Oh shit! Yeah, I just noticed that.
Yeah, and then I added in a page into the main story to showcase his robotic foot, because we fell in love with this stupid robotic foot, and that's the kind of stuff where it's like you play off other people's
like their foibles and their eccentricities, and then again, like in my mind, I know how we got to that point. So, I mean, there's always like little, oh, wait, so he was going to do that story. You pulled him off and he did this one. And then this story fits into this issue, not the third issue. So his story got held. We were going to put it in issue 3 and held it for issue 4 because we felt it worked better with the main story. So there's a lot of moving parts that, you know, the reader can just read it and enjoy it. But like as the editor director of one of these things, you start to see a lot of moving pieces of like this. We did this. We had said stop, go, change, different people. You know, add this. Oh, wait, this guy made a change. Let's go back and change our stuff to make it fit his idea because we like his idea better than our idea, right?
Yeah. And honestly, like that foot, like the robotic foot, like I honestly probably wouldn't have noticed that if you hadn't pointed it out. And it's such like a small detail.
Yes.
That like, honestly, like you wouldn't have even had to do it. Like you could have just put a boot over it and had it never been a thing. But like the fact that it's like there kind of behind the cat, that like if you catch it, especially if like you get that cover and you read that story, because yeah, it's in the pages on the Kickstarter where he's being drugged away by the cat and like half of his one leg is just gone,
right? And that's the kind of crazy stuff. When I was a kid, I would see like role-playing game art or fighting fantasy game books. Shout out to Russ Nicholson, the greatest fighting fantasy game book artist of all time. He's awesome. That those black and white pen and ink guys would put so much absurd detail into their art that like as a kid, I would be like, what's in that guy's backpack or where's that orc going? Right. So to me, when I do things like the mechanical foot, you know, where we saw one of our other team members doing it, and we were like, why did you do that? And he goes, I just thought it was cool. And we're like, oh yeah, that is cool. Like, we want more mechanical foot, you know? And then you start to play off what they did, you know, like you're improvising like comedians or actors where it's like someone said something really funny. Don't read your line, play off their joke. It's better, right? It's a better joke. Do it, you know?
And it gives you like a different, it gives you something else to play with that character now.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you this, and I'm not going to say who it was, but it's a funny story. I can share more in detail in person if anybody ever wants to hear my story. But a publisher asked me to draw one of their characters. I thought the character was kind of dumb, but I said, hey, it's a little, you know, it's a professional gig, whatever. And I did this character, and I did my best to hit their character model sheet. And they actually complained at me. They said, the hair has 3 curls. You have 2? And I'm like, I have 3. And like, well, that's not really a curl. And I was like, wow. No, you guys like, and then they had their main artist that works on this book send me my pose drawn in their style. So I was like, okay. And then I just redrew my art exactly like their main artist. And they're like, well, no, you're just copying their work. And I was like, no.
What do you want?
Yeah. And it's like, look, I know you like your artist. He's your guy and he sells books and that's fine. Right. But like, you know what I do. Why did you ask me to do this? And then I give you a Jason Lennox version of your character and you're literally complaining about an additional curl in the hair, which I would argue my curls were the appropriate amount of curls. And now you're arguing about what is and what is not a curl. And it's like, y'all need to embrace, like, I embrace the artists doing their own thing. As long as we can, like, a basic connection from that character sheet of who they are. Like, the main hero, Aegis, has his big Roman helmet or Greek helmet. He can't be wearing a cowboy hat. I'm going to check you on that.
Yeah.
Right? But if you're Greek helmet is a little bit different. I mean, like, we know who it is, and it's just I embrace the diversity of visual styles. I love it. I embrace it. I think it's great. It's like cover songs. I love cover songs.
Yeah. Look at Batman. Like Batman's a really easy, like, well-known character to look at. Like, you know, some people draw him with like giant cape all over, like I'm also very 90s Batman at the moment, but like, you know,
yeah,
giant cape curled all over the place, like giant horns coming off the helmet and then other people, you know, real subdued, just like the cape is just down to like his ankle, like real tiny little horns coming off the cowl.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's different interpretations. It's all that artist's style.
And you know what, maybe you would see a Batman, like I know Kelly Jones is an artist that is like, I never liked Kelly Jones' version of Batman. Not that he did a bad job. It just wasn't my cup of tea, right? But I recently saw Mike Mignola Batman that I thought was really cool. Kelly Jones and Mike Mignola are it's completely different. I liked one, so I didn't like the other. You know, so what?
So it's funny. I just looked up the Kelly Jones Batman. Because I just couldn't picture it in my head, and actually those were the horns I was thinking of, like those. Just
but see, you like that, right? I mean, well, here's the thing: it's just not my cup of tea. But it's not my cup of tea. It doesn't invalidate it. It isn't like, oh, you know, it's bad. It's like, no, it's just I don't like it. But we've had probably 1,000 different Batman versions at this point. But as long as they keep this a couple basic things together, you can still identify it. And like I said, I think Batman's stronger. Because it's had so many, I mean, I think Jim Lee's Batman's killer. But Jim Lee's Batman is not, you know, Neil Adams. But Neil Adams.
Yeah, no, they're two very different characters.
Yeah, and I like George Perez Batman, too. And George Perez is a very crisp, clean, you know, it's just, so, I mean, to me, there's a real power and strength that comes from playing off those artists. And like I said, Joe went with his mechanical foot thing. And we just, I don't know why that thing was a big part of the book, was that damn mechanical foot. Now, again, if you didn't talk to me, I might not even notice it, but I'm telling you, that was a big thing for us.
Yeah. So I actually, just to rewind for a second, I have a quick question. Cause I actually didn't know this.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So if you get like work for hire, like at a publisher where they want you to like draw a cover or something like that, let's say, like, they will give you, like, a sheet of, like, all the things you have to hit for, like, the way the character looks?
Well, yeah. So, in this case, I was given, you know, their model sheets, and it was like, okay, so this character has these things. And I was literally like, okay, check. I mean, I was trying my best to, like, hit every single one. And it's kind of a negative story for people that are around. I don't want to badmouth anybody on it. I think it's a pretty funny story. I actually saved all the files and screen. And it was one of those things. It's bizarre. I've actually told people the story. I've told people the story at shows. And then I'm like, send me an email and I'll send you all the files because people say, I got to see what you're talking about. And then I would send them the stuff and they would be like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it sounds very nitpicky from the way you described it. So as somebody with zero ability to like draw, I can't draw a stick figure.
Sure.
I kind of thought, like, I was just always under the impression, like, you know, if somebody is asking you to like do a cover for something, like, you know, it's probably, it's just kind of assumed that, like, you know, if you're drawing Spider-Man, you know what Spider-Man looks like. You're meant to do your interpretation of Spider-Man. Like, if it's the red and blue suit Spider-Man and you put him in the symbiote suit, like, yeah, you messed up, like, redo it. But if you draw him in a red and black suit and he looks like Spider-Man and he's swinging off a web like Spider-Man, like, you drew Spider-Man. Like, what's the big deal?
it's the strangeness of people that, yeah, I mean, again, like, I always think about that where it was like, you want everything to look like your main artist. Why are you talking? Like, it was one of the strange, and remind me, I'll send you all the stuff. Now you're like, I want to see it. I want to see it.
I am curious.
it's bizarre. And it was so unprofessional and so poorly done on their part. Then I really felt rude, but you know, here's the thing. It's a great, funny story. So, you know, hey, that's priceless, having humor, right?
And you know what? And you can tell the story, have it be funny and entertaining without actually saying who or what it was. So, like, 100%. You're not bad mouthing a publisher or a character or an editor or anything like that.
No.
You're just, like this happened. They didn't like what I did, but it's kind of funny when you think about it.
Well, the visuals make it really funny. Hey, if any fans want to see this stuff, just drop me a line at LenoxArts. I'll share it with anybody, but I won't share it publicly. But it is a Jason Lennox Theater, the bizarre story that it's been years since this went down, but it's still just kind of eye rolling. But here's the thing. I actually do think about that when I had to put on my editor cap for Lords of the Cosmos, because I try not to be like that. I mean, unless stuff is totally, and we actually, it has never come up where if things were totally out of line where it's like, I don't even recognize if this character is supposed to be, you know, a dragon and you drew a cow, like that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, like there's a certain level of like creative, like artistic liberty. There you go. That's the creative license is what I was looking for, but could not get those words to go together.
I couldn't remember more Danix earlier, right? The character we designed and built the toy for. I'm like that guy.
Here's what he looks like. I know exactly what he looks like. I could draw him right now for you.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, again, like, do you embrace diversity in your visual style or are you slavish to, you know, everything must look exactly like this? Now, in animation, right, you have a key character designer and key animators that will say, this is what this character looks like. They can't deviate from it because it has to remain, like, you know, I love Rick and Morty, right? My kids got me into watching it over quarantine. So, like, I love Rick and Morty now. And, like, Rick and Morty have to look like Rick and Morty, right?
Yeah, and even the side characters, like, even if you don't like Bird Person. He might not show up for 10 episodes, but he's still got to look like the same bird person when he pops back up.
So all the artists, I mean, they give them, you know, sheets where it's like, here's every emotion for Bird Person from every angle. So like, if you're doing Bird Person, he has to look a certain way. So, I mean, in that trade, yeah, you can't say, hey, you know, Jason's going to draw Bird Person one way and Chris is going to draw him totally different, but you can't do that. But that's animation. That's not art. So, I mean, it's just understanding what you're, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the best parts about like the comics as a medium is whether it's like a self-published book, like Lords of the Cosmos or, you know, your big books from like DC or Marvel, you know, everyone gets to have kind of their interpretation of what it is that they're doing.
Yeah, and here's the thing. If there's artists that you like, you know, I think Jim Lee's one of those guys that you see Jim's work and you understand why he's a superstar. I'm always curious when Jim draws anything because he's so good that, like, he could draw Garfield and Odie and make it seem wildly interesting because he, you know, like, it's like, what is the Jim Lee lens on this? And there could be guys that you don't like their lens where you're just like, I don't like anything this guy does. So whatever he does, I'm not interested in.
Yeah, exactly. Like there are some artists where it's, you know, like I read a lot of comic books. And like there are some books where I'll stick with the book through like an artist that maybe I'm not a huge fan of, just because I want to stay with that story. But I'm not looking at every page being like, man, every one of these pages is great. And like, there's some books where like I have followed it specifically because an artist was on it. Like, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but like, there have been times where like I was reading one book with an artist, loved his work. He went to something else. I'm like, well, I'm just going to go read that book too, even though I didn't really have an interest in it beforehand.
Well, we've had two really high end artists pass away in the last year that I'll name check. One was Juan Jimenez, and to this day, I could be butchering his name, but he's the Meta Barons guy. Did a lot of stuff that you might have seen in heavy metal over the years. And
okay.
Juan, he died of COVID. He was an older gentleman. He was originally from Spain, and he lived in, I want to say, Argentina for a long time. He was a legit superstar artist. And if you don't know who this guy is, Google him, because he's absurdly good. Anything that he made, I would buy. If it was a book, it was a comic book, anything that guy made, I'd buy it. I mean, he was just that good. It didn't matter what he was, I would buy it. Rich Corbin, same thing. If Richard Corbin was drawing a book, I would try to buy it. You know, in the last 10 years, he did a lot more commercial properties where he was doing things like Alien and Marvel books, but he cut his teeth doing these amazing independent things. He was in the very first issue of Heavy Metal. He passed away recently too. You know, I don't think it was because of COVID, but he was also an older gentleman.
Yeah, I just looked. He literally like just passed away in December, and he was 80.
You know, but like Rich Corbin and Juan Jimenez, I mean, those guys were just like hands down awesome. Like if they were drawing, I don't know, like the airplane safety pamphlet, I would have probably picked up a copy because
just to have it on your shelf.
Yeah, whatever they did was awesome. Straight up, it was just awesome work. And again, if you don't know Juan Jimenez, I mean, that guy, I don't know how he wasn't bigger in the U.S. Like when he passed, you saw like comic book luminaries in the States saying this guy was like a guy that like hands down was just top skill, like tops, like unreal ability. I've always viewed Jim Lee as kind of like the top end of like U.S. comic book artists. Juan might have been better than him by quite a bit.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, like Jim Lee is easily up there. Like,
yeah, I would say if there was someone better than Jim, it might be Juan. Now, Juan, I think the reason he wasn't more popular in the U.S. is he was doing a lot of kind of oddball independent stuff that was maybe more European. See, he wasn't doing like Batman per se, right? Because Jim Lee's awesome, but he's done a lot of really popular stuff. So it's like two great things that go together. But if you get a minute, look up Juan Jimenez. But my point is, anything I could buy of Juan Jimenez, I will buy. I will still buy it. It's just hard to get his stuff. But
yeah,
anything that guy would draw, I'd buy it, hands down.
Yeah, which, I mean, like, there are plenty of, like your mainstream, U.S.-based artists that, like, I'm in the same boat. Like, I followed them. I'm 34, so, like, I remember coming up with comics in, like, the 90s when everything was Pouches and Lens Flare. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But so, you know, like your Jim Lee's, your Todd McFarlane, basically all the Image guys.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like all those guys are kind of like, you know, you see something, you're immediately like, this looks like this guy was inspired by like Jim Lee's X-Men or McFarlane's Spider-Man or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, do yourself a favor. Check out, I mean, for everyone listening, if you like comics, go check out Meta Barons, which was the book by Alexander Yodorovsky and drawn by Juan Jimenez, which if you really want to go into the craziness of that book, there's a documentary called Yodorovsky's Dune, which Yodorovsky was going to make a version of Dune in the early 70s that never got made. And his storyboard artist was Mobius, and H.R. Giger,
oh, wow,
or Giger was one of the character or one of the creature designers for the movie, right? And basically the entire creative team that made Alien was pulled off the Dune project after that project collapsed. And when I was watching the documentary, there was all these things from this film that never happened. I'm like, but that really sounds like Meta Baron, right? And then at the very end of the documentary, he's like, yes, I was unable to do this, so I made Meta Barons and I brought in one. And I was
cool.
I was like, oh, what? So, you know, talking about like the mechanical foot and like the little Lords of the Cosmos stuff, where if you want to see a crazy documentary, watch Jodorowsky's Dune, which is nuts. It's just a crazy creative documentary. And then go check out the comic book Meta Barons, which like Juan Jimenez is it about, if not equal to Mobius, like skill wise, in my opinion. So Mobius did like 2,000 pages of storyboards for this movie that never occurred.
Jesus.
And then Jimenez ends up making this comic book that's kind of based off of this version of Dune that never got made. But it's, again, it's just this crazy creative cauldron with how this stuff gets made and everything else. But yeah.
Yeah, I actually just I brought up some of his work, and like, it's insane. Like, it's got this old school level of realism, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it Juan is like old master level ability, but he's doing like robots, fighter planes, like spaceships. So it's almost like if you saw the Sistine Chapel drawn as science fiction.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's got almost like this oil painting. Some of the stuff anyway has like this oil painting vibe. I'm not sure if it is painted or not, but yeah, it's like that water. like cyberpunk, like so much like fine little detail and everything. It's insane.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is going back to we got to get back off this tangent onto the main route of this discussion. Is that like I embrace the diversity, and like I want to see Corbin, you know, over the years draw, you know, Alien, because what's Corbin going to do with it? And again, to me, the more you embrace diverse visual standpoints, not that you even have to like all of them, I think it makes things better, because it's just it's a broader pool. The more eyes and hands you have, like one of the things that I've had to learn is that you have to be humble and realize there's a ton of people that are better than you, and it's easy to be jealous and be like, no, I'm smarter or better. You hit that point where it's like, you know what? I got to let my ego go. And if there's people around me that have better ideas, I'm going to embrace and support that, because you know what? I'm going to win with them. I don't need to fight every single fight for no reason. And what are you fighting? You know what I mean? Like, why are you fighting like better people? Like, so by having more people, you get really cool ideas, whether it's visual or narrative, to say, whoa, when we listen to these extra five or six people, they gave us 30 gems, and they're all part of the collective projects. So like Lords of the Cosmos, we've had so many individual great ideas that have come from, you know, the bullpen, right? The Lords of the Cosmos Ugly Studios bullpen, right? That I'm blessed that all these people have given their time and talent to make this project even better, you know, that they've given that, and we've been smart enough to not say, no, I didn't think of it, we can't do that idea. And it's like, no, that's a really good idea. You have good ideas too, but it's okay if that guy and that lady, if they have good ideas too, use them. It is smart, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's very easy to fight that, to say, no, I didn't think of it, you know, blah, 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 you know, but it's
ego. As long as you can keep your own ego kind of like in check, you're open to what other people might have to offer.
And it's hard, man. When I was younger, I'll be transparent. When I was younger, you know, if I was in my 20s, I'd have probably been like, no, it's not my, I mean, I would have been the guy with my ego. I think as you get older, you get smarter. And you learn to put your ego in check, just because you don't need to have everything your way. It's okay if you don't have the best idea every single time something's brought up. Maybe you have a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know?
And even if your idea is not bad, maybe somebody else just has an idea that is different, and different works better.
Or takes your idea and shines it up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I realize we've been talking about kind of the universe in like broad strokes. If you don't mind, at least.
Yeah, go ahead.
Why don't you give like the elevator pitch on the actual story so far?
So Lords of the Cosmos takes its cues from things like Thundercats, Flash Gordon, and Masters of the Universe. And what it is, it's a planet that is out of time. It's out of space. And it has magic, technology, talking animals, cyborgs, and robots. And it is rocked, and it has been rocked by a group of superpowered villains called the Disciples of Umex, led by Umex. And they have been opposed for quite some time now by the Lords of the Cosmos, who are led by characters that in many ways resemble Greek gods from Earth. And they've been fighting for decades on this planet for control. And the planet has suffered. And where the first issue picks up is in the aftermath of their last worldwide war, where it is like World War II with like monsters, robots, and creatures. And this is now, you're picking up in the aftermath of that world of magic, robots, technology, all merged together, fighting for basically the life of this planet. and the good guys are good guys, and the bad guys, they are bad. They're very black and white. And that's the elevator pitch, which, if you think about that 1980s vibe that, you know, I keep mentioning, were those 80s cartoons. They were kind of black and white. They were kind of simplistic. We're not as simplistic, per se, with the maybe the plots and stories, but we try to have some really bad, bad guys and some really good, good guys with a little bit of conflict mixed into them. So if that's your cup of tea, if you like things like Thundar the Barbarian, right, Black Star, that old Filmation cartoon, those are the kind of things that you'd read this and say, yeah, you know what, I'm kind of feeling that. And if you like that and that's your cup of tea, yeah. You know, but if you like, you know, things like, you know, I'm trying to like kind of more Neil Gaiman's more thoughtful death comics, it's probably not your cup of tea.
That's fair.
yeah. I mean, it's probably not your cup. You know, if you like Slayer, you may not like REM. Maybe you do, but you know, it's okay.
You can definitely like both.
Yeah, you could like both, but I'm just saying if you want to see Slayer and you've got your heart set on seeing them, there's other bands that are like Slayer, but if you're really in that mood, you know, REM's probably not your mood that day, right? So
yeah,
I mean, that's my elevator pitch to it is, you know, science fantasy. I think we dubbed the genre name science fiction barbarians is kind of the genre for it, right? Science fiction barbarian.
Which, I mean, up like from the three issues I've read, like that works. And it really does, like, I mean, like I said it a little while ago, like I'm in my mid 30s. So like I grew up kind of like past that, like peak 80s cartoon era, like Masters of the Universe, Transformers, all that stuff. Like I watched all that stuff later, like on repeats and stuff like that. But like, I still remember those things. I still remember like the toys and how, you know, but like you said, like you basically launched this book with 40 characters. Like you came up with 40 characters that kind of fit that era of entertainment.
So the guy that makes our model toys, he's in my age, or I think he might be a little bit younger than me. I'm 40. And he said, you know, I'm looking at these Lords of the Cosmos toys and these characters. And he goes, the regular characters, they're kind of like maybe the birthday gifts, and these bigger characters, they're more like the Christmas gifts. He goes, because I remember getting those catalogs and circling stuff. And my mom would say, that's too big. You get that for Christmas or your birthday. And I was like, oh, yeah, that was kind of the because a lot of even designing the characters was thinking about getting JCPenney's catalogs at Christmas and circling. As a kid, I would flip to like the Transformer G.I. Joe page and they would have like, here's all the action figures and here's the play sets in the vehicle. Right.
Yeah, like you weren't getting the giant battle carrier for G.I. Joe for like your birthday or something like that. Yeah. That was like the Christmas gift that year.
You were praying to maybe get the Jeep and two action figures. So even the Lords of the Cosmos, you know, the scale model sheets, you know, which are in issue 3, you can see them there in black and white. We emailed people from the Kickstarter the PDF so they could see them in color. But, you know, there's the regular people-ish size ones. And then each team has 3 that are kind of bigger. And then each side has like one gigantic character. And, you know, it was so crazy when Eric said that, Eric Adi, who sculpts these things for us, that he made that connection. He's like, dude, I'm seeing like the birthday Christmas toys and the regular toys. Oh, my God. He goes, I feel this. I feel the toy set. So to me, when we have those like little connections with people, that's what we're trying to do. So, again, if you're hearing what I'm saying and you're like, oh, yeah, I grew up with that. The toy catalog. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the bigger toys are for birthdays and Christmases. Oh, my God. I remember that. Then again, then this comic is for you. Like if what I'm saying makes sense, if you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth, you should check out this book. But if you're like, what is this guy talking about? I'm not saying you can't enjoy this book because you certainly could, but it may not have that like emotional, oh my goodness, like, dude, like you're speaking to me about my childhood, like in a very direct way that almost makes me want to cry because it makes me feel good.
Yeah. And because you are, you're hitting that, you're hitting nostalgia beats with original creations, like it's bringing up those feelings of growing up in the 80s and 90s, and it's like, no, I remember this stuff, but these are just new versions of it, basically. It's like, right. You know, it's when they killed all the Gen 1 Transformers and brought all the new ones in with the movie.
So true story about that. I remember as a child, my mother took me to see that at the Dutch Wonderland movie theater down outside of Lancaster.
And oh, man.
We went to see Transformers movie when it came out that week. And when Optimus Prime died, I stood up in theater and cheered. because I was down for Megatron, and my mom said that kids were crying in the theater and parents were staring at my mom because I was being a total ass cheering for the death of Optimus Prime. And she's
so
like,
how old would you have been?
11.
Okay, yeah, because I guess, what was that, 86?
86. So I was born in 75, so I think that was a late summer film. My birthday's in March, so I would have been 11, yeah.
Yeah, and for anyone listening that doesn't know, there was a cartoon Transformers movie in 1986.
Yes.
That is where they originally killed Optimus. It wasn't in the Michael Bay sequel.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about that film was it was high-end. I think it was made in Korea. It's super high-end, like, hand-drawn animation. And the crazy thing about that was the movie ratings board said, yeah, you're good to kill these characters because they're not people. They're just, like, toasters. So you can kill anyone you want, right? Not realizing that, like, the original G1 Autobots, as far as children, I think, saw them, they were written like a family, and they looked like people, and they had really great voice actors. They were incredibly relatable. No, look, I was a sinister kid, so I was down with like Soundwave and Starscream and Megatron. But they were for a kid's after school cartoon. It was incredibly well written, and I think, you know, whatever it is, the MPAA was just like, yeah, whatever. I mean, like, we're not going to cry about an oil filter getting thrown out, are we? Sure, kill them. But they kill them, and the animators, that movie is like gangland-style executions. And I think they got rocked by this, like, the reaction my mother saw of kids crying and, like, me being like, yeah, good, kill them. And it's really an amazing payoff to, like, Starscream's always trying to get one over on Megatron. Oh, wait, now he does, and it's very brutal. He murders him. He throws him in outer space to like die.
Yeah, I mean, it's been I don't know that I've seen that movie in 15 years.
Dude, but Ironhide crawls to Megatron screaming, and Megatron just says something like pathetic and like shoots him point blank in the face from a worm's eye view, and you're like, good lord. Yeah.
Yeah, they went all the way with it, and they really did. They cleaned house. They got rid of every single character they possibly could.
Yes, because you could buy more toys.
It was toys. Like that was how you get more toys.
Yeah. So again, if any of this stuff, if you're hearing this and you're like, yeah, like again, this, and again, not that a kid who's 18 couldn't read Lords of the Cosmos and enjoy it, because one thing I don't like is this kind of slavish love for nostalgia where we've morphed into, I know what that is, let me laugh or smile. And like, I get that. But like, if you're only relying on people saying, the member berries, like, I remember that. Like, if you took Force Awakens and took out the Millennium Falcon and put in like another ship and pulled Harrison Ford and put an older man into it, I don't think anyone would have liked that film.
Yeah, no, I mean, that whole out, not to debate Star Wars, out of the sequel trilogy.
Right. Like, we'll have a minor detour, but we won't debate it. But go ahead.
Yeah. Out of the sequel trilogy, like, I liked Force Awakens the most because it had that nostalgia for me. Yeah. And as somebody that was way too into Star Wars at growing up, like, I already had an idea of what I wanted those sequels to be because I read the books and everything that had been being published for 30 years since the movies were out. And then, like, I think Rian Johnson, wonderful filmmaker. The Last Jedi, not the movie I wanted.
Here's the thing. I think my problem with a lot of this stuff is, again, Force Awakens to me sticks out as a real bad example of it, or a good example of doing, I don't think a good thing, is if you took the Star Wars-y stuff out of it and just merited that as a film, it's really just...
It'd be boring.
It's a really not a good film. But I remember I saw it the weekend it came out, and I was not happy with it at all at the theaters because I kind of got a feel for what was going on. And every time something that the fans knew, it's like, okay, here's these new characters that are kind of just, okay, they're just kind of young people, you know, neither good nor bad. But what got all the applause was stuff they knew. It's member berries. And so to me, we wanted Lords of the Cosmos, to your point, to give that feeling, but not by just this, I mean, just insane level of like, we have to just bring the stuff out because we can't do anything new. Only thing we can do is bring out this old stuff that everyone knows. And there's too much of that going on with comic books and movies where it's just like, make up something original.
Yeah. Dude, Marvel just announced that they're doing another Clone Saga for Miles.
Like, I mean, again, it's just like, here's the thing. I got spoiled and didn't realize it. I mean, I grew up going to see Indiana Jones Raiders when I was six. You know, I saw RoboCop when I was 12, you know, and all the, you know, Predator, Aliens, all this stuff. And it was just like one cool thing after the next. And you didn't realize it, but it was just like those films were like original. Aliens, maybe not as much as the original Alien, right? But it just...
But Aliens is different than Alien. They're both amazing.
We were so spoiled with, like, you just take a film like RoboCop, right? Everything in RoboCop, when you saw it, was like original. I mean, from the catchphrases to the cool characters to the cool character designs. And it was just like, here you go. They still haven't made anything to beat it. And they keep trying to make more RoboCop, and every single one is like not good. And it's just like, we were so spoiled with original cool stuff. And again, I think it's cool to have nostalgia beats, but I really appreciate you saying that about Lords, because that was the whole point, to give you those feelings, but not just be like, hey, it's just stuff. I mean, not that we could legally even do that, because we couldn't, but you get tired of just like, let's just trot this same old stuff out, because we know that the fans, we'll take it. We're going to take advantage of the fans. And I don't dig that. Like, try to make up like, okay, so my Clone Saga, it's like, good God.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas with Lords, it's like you're not going to sneak Skeletor into an issue. I mean, you might like draw somebody with a skull face or something like that, but like you're not going to have him come out cackling in an issue, because like you said, like you don't own those rights. Like you can't, like you get in trouble.
But you know, why can't companies make up a new RoboCop or a new Star Wars, a new Skeletor? They don't seem. I think they could, but I think there's such a fear with money that it's like, look. If we have an idea, be it a comic book. I mean, look at this thing you just mentioned, Miles Morales. Hey, here's an idea. What if we just redid Clone Saga? And someone else is like, well, I have a totally different Miles Morales idea. Let's do something to it. Yeah, but people know Clone Saga, so it's a lower risk. Do that.
And it's hit that point now where it's hit that nostalgia point where people look back on it fondly. Like, I'll be honest, like, Ben Reilly is one of my favorite comic book characters. I love Scarlet Spider. like, the Clone Saga is a rough story.
I remember it not being that well liked at the time.
Exactly. And like they've gone back to it a few times since then. And like people are just like, oh, right, clones. I remember the 90s? Like you were saying, like it's that member berries.
Oh,
like,
man, the member berries. I mean, I think South Park is genius a lot of times. It falls flat occasionally. But member berries, I was like, this is where we're at. Where it's like, remember that?
Yeah. And that's really, I mean, superhero stuff aside, because like I don't do you follow a lot of like mainstream comics still? Or,
you know, here's the thing, I working full-time, having two kids in third grade and kindergarten, taking care of a house.
Oh, you have no free time anymore.
Yeah, I try to keep up with my anime and my DC animated movies and a handful of like Japanese comics that I still love to read, and I have a stack of them that I can't even get to, so I'll be honest. It's an issue of time. I still don't have.
Yeah. No. I totally understand that. But
I kept a lot going to cons, and I could be like, oh yeah, and like read books while I was at shows.
That's that's a good way. Like if you have downtime, like you get to catch up on something.
Yeah. So not as much as I should.
But so like you have like you have your MCU movies, you have your DC movies, like they're two. To anybody else, they're quote unquote original property. Like I might know what story that's based on. You might know what story that's based on, but random dude over there that has never been to a comic book shop, he knows it's based on a comic book, but he couldn't tell you what the actual history of it was. Like,
no,
my wife and I, we watched the first episodes of WandaVision over the weekend. Which if you haven't watched it and you have Disney Plus, it's actually really cool. Okay. They did a really cool job with like the old school sitcom throwback.
Okay.
But I've got the comic books thing going on where I'm like looking at all these like little Easter eggs. Like I saw a sword logo at one point, or like the Hydra logo that they made very obvious. Like I'm seeing all those little things. I'm like, oh, they're doing this, they're doing that. Like I see names and credits of like comic book creators. I'm like, oh, they are doing this. Like this is definitely connected to House of M. Like Bendis and Oliver Copiel, I think is how you say his last name, like are both credited in the credits of one of the episodes. Like, but like your general person that doesn't read all any of that stuff, they're just looking at it like, oh, this is cool. Like, I don't know what this is, but I'm entertained by it.
Yeah, and here's the thing, I know basically what WandaVision is, and I think that's kind of cool because it's a little bit off the beaten path. But I think ultimately the biggest thing is if you're relying on the member berries to make this stuff fly, I don't think you've made good entertainment, which isn't to say that you can't make a lot of money doing it.
They keep doing it. They keep making way more money than you'd expect them to.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I'm a huge Blade Runner fan, and I got sucked into the member berries. I went and saw Blade Runner 2049, and I walked out of the theater feeling dirty, and I was like, I don't ever want to see that film again. It was like, let's shoehorn in CGI Sean Young and Grandpa Harrison Ford, and I'm like, why do they need to be in the... Their participation in the film was just like this bizarre... Remember Sean Young? She was really pretty in 1982, and it's like...
And they're going to do another Indiana Jones movie. They're scripting Indiana Jones 5, apparently, with Harrison.
So, can I just say one thing really quick about that? Is the guy that's... Isn't he almost 80?
If he's not almost 80, he's at least mid-70s.
Yeah, how... Like, my dad is, like, 72, and, like, he gets tired, and, like, he's kind of slow now.
He is 78 years old.
What's that?
Harrison Ford is 78 years old.
I mean, he's older than my dad. And, like, hey, Dad, I don't mean anything ill by this, but, like, my dad, like, you know, does a couple things. He's like, yeah, I got to take a little rest here. Like, I'm going to sit down. He'll fall asleep just sitting on the couch. And it's like, so what, a guy 6 years older than my dad, we're supposed to buy him, what, slugging it out with, like, 25-year-old tough guy? I mean, it's just kind of like, what? It's so dumb.
I don't disagree. The one thing I will throw out there, Bruce Springsteen is 71. I saw him a year, maybe 2 years ago. So he would have been 69 at the time. That man ran back and forth across the stage for 3 hours.
Well, I will say this. I've seen Judas Priest a number of times in the last 3 years, and Rob Halford is an older gentleman at this point, and he belts and he rocks, even though he's a guy, he's in his 60s, it might be like 65. But
he's 69, holy crap.
Rob Halford, 69?
Yeah.
Well, so I would have guessed 65. But I mean, he still belts, man. But I don't know. I don't know. Now we're going to debate like physical fitness with older people, but like I can buy running around on stage, but I can't buy like fist. Like what is my dad going to fist fight a guy who's like ripped, who's 24?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the last one. Like I guess that was, God, that was over 10 years ago.
I know.
So he would have been like late 60s at the time, mid to late 60s.
Right.
And like he wasn't getting into fist fights with people. Like they had, what's his, the kid doing all the stupid stuff. Like he did his classic, like, oh, something's happening, I'm going to shoot him. And like, that's funny, like one time, maybe two, but like at a certain point, like Indy's not going to be chasing down like a moving truck, like not in his 80s. But yeah, no, I agree. Like at a certain point, like nostalgia's great, but like move it, like give us something different. Like they everything's getting remade nowadays. Like, I mean, there's that new Ghostbusters that's coming out again.
Yeah, and again, here's the thing. When I see things that give me nostalgia feels that are still original, and look, there's other people doing that. To me, that's fun. I guess I'm to the point now, because I live through all this stuff, I'm checked out of the memory scene. So if you make things that give me the feels but throw me originality, I'm in. So I just try to make the things that I like, but just the slavish, you know, dedication to, we must have the stuff that we've seen, and here's the Oh, I hate the memories. Oh, remember?
Yeah, just
remember?
We're gonna keep recycling these characters and see where it gets us. Let's see if we can break a billion this time.
On that note, I think, you know, we may have seen the last of these billion-dollar films, because I don't know how that recovers in COVID. I think this era. I mean, Infinity War may be the last big movie. I mean, it's just cramming people in the theaters for, you know, a month and a half. I don't know when we'll see that again. I think we will see it again, but I don't know when.
And honestly, like, I don't know that we're going to see it like that ever again, because I don't think those theaters can survive is the thing.
Well,
and you people know, are going to use VOD.
Well, I think that, but I'll tell you a third thing. So one, people get used to watching at home. Two, the theaters may not be there. But I'll tell you the third thing is, it's like abuse. Like, you knock the, you know, the fear of God into everyone about going out, and you're going to die and get sick, you know, and then in a year and a half, most of the population's vaccinated. This thing's kind of, you know, getting beaten down. You may have, so like my one friend, Jeff, hey Jeff, like we always go to concerts and we have tickets to go see Lamb of God this summer that we bought last July. Who knows if they're even going to have it. we were talking the other day, and I was like, yeah, I don't know. And he goes, you know what, buddy? He goes, we've gone to concerts together for over a decade. And I was like, yeah. He goes, I may never go to one again. I said, well, yeah, but you'll get your shot and, you know, and all that. He goes, yeah, but what if there's a, and again, Jeff, sorry if I'm misquoting, but I think he said something like, what if there's another virus? And I was like, so you're saying you just may never feel comfortable going to something like that? He goes, no, I don't know if I, and he goes, I'm not saying I am, but he goes, I might. And I'm thinking he may never go to a concert with me again because he actually is just kind of spooked, you know?
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, which is understandable.
Hey, I'm not going to tell him he's wrong. I get it. He's scared, you know? And, but the thing is, it's like if someone abuses you, in this case, we're being abused by a virus, like, and we scare you for a long period of time. And then I'm like, all good. Does the person that gets abused feel like going out in public, right? Maybe ever. Maybe they're like, no, I'm just going to stay home. I'm scared. I got beat up.
Yeah. Like,
people just may say, I'm just not going out.
Yeah. Like, I'm drawing blanks on the words I want to use. I'm a big guy for like movies and concerts. Like, I love going to the movies. I love going to concerts. I go to I'm super into punk rock. So like, I've seen like NoFX and stuff like that a bunch of times. Like, those are the concerts I love going to. I was actually supposed to go see Green Day back in August, but obviously that didn't happen. And it's like right now the idea of like going into Philly and going to like the Electric Factory and being crammed in with, you know,
great venue, however many people.
Oh yeah, no, I love the Electric Factory.
Yeah.
You know, however many people fit in that place, being crammed in with them. Like, I saw, now I'm drawing blanks. I saw Flogging Molly and Anti-Flag there, like, 2018. And just spent the entire time just as wedged together with people as you could possibly be. And it's like, I don't want that right now. And I don't know when I want that again. Like, I want to go to a concert, but, like, I don't know that I'm going to be in the crowd.
You were backing up what I just said, because it's like,
yeah,
maybe now Chris is comfortable going to Electric Factory. I think that place holds about 1,500 when it's packed. Maybe you'd be comfortable now if it was 500.
And yeah, or at least I'd be up on like a balcony or something like that rather than like down on the floor.
And if they tell you, well, no balcony is available and we're going to crowd the place because we need to do it to pay our bills, you may just say, yeah, I'm not going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, like your friend said, you know, like, I just don't know. I don't know what the people there are doing because like everyone's got their own impression. And at least where we're at right now, like, we don't know what this vaccine does long term. Like, not like side effect wise, just like coverage wise. Like,
well, we don't know.
If I get it and you get it, but then like the third person doesn't get it, like,
can I pass
what does that mean for them? Yeah. Can I pass it to them? Yeah. Like, well, is it going to expire in 6 months and they can pass it back to me? Like,
well, here's the thing. I'm getting that vaccine as soon as I can. And I think obviously you are too. But like we're saying, like, but like you said, like, what if I get it? Can I still pass it? I mean, there's so many questions. Like, I'm going to get it because it's better than when we're at. But there are legitimate questions. Like, you know, like you said, does it last for a year, lifetime, 6 months? Do I have to get it every year? How effective is it? Can I still get it? You know, can I get it and not be affected and pass it to other people? And it's like, I don't know. I'll take the risk and roll with it if there is a risk. But like, you're right. I mean, so will people, and again, hey, Jeff, like, will people like Jeff just say, I'm never going to a concert. I'm never going to go to a crowded movie. And do people like Jeff just say, I'll just stay home?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, and we don't get some of these things. Man, this is, we'll have to do a whole movie talk sometime. We've definitely
got
the rails. What else?
So, as far as,
go ahead.
Sorry. So as far as the Kickstarter goes,
yes.
Just to kind of like talk about that a little broad again. Mm-hmm. So this is the fourth one you're doing, obviously it's issue four. I was being like the online stalker and like looking through your Kickstarter profile earlier.
Oh, good.
So like this is actually the 10th one that you've created.
I think this is my 11th. This is the new one. I think I've done
10. Oh, right. Right. You've created 10. So this one isn't showing yet. So like, this is not like a new thing for you.
No.
All four issues of Lords of the Cosmos have been funded successfully. And it looks like every one so far, you've seen an increase in backers.
Yeah. So, well, not all four, cause we haven't done the fourth one yet, but yeah, no, that everyone has seen more, backers, going into it, and Kickstarter definitely is up their game. So the big thing is now they have a pre-launch sign up. So I've been able to kind of do a little more pre-promoting than I've ever done, where I'm encouraging people, hey, sign up on day one. And obviously day one backers are really important to your metrics. I've been doing Kickstarters now for 9 years, and I've gotten pretty good at it. And you know, I think Lords has slowly grown as a brand, and I'm hoping we set a new record for day one and a new record for dollars and backers on this one. And hey, I've always delivered, you know, you can look at the comments and see people. I've always gone out of my way to take care of people. I'm not going to say I've been perfect about being on time, but if you even go look at my projects with the updates, two had a couple delays. There was a ton of updates. Like, this is exactly what's happening. You know, where I go out of my way to make sure that if people are giving me money, I don't want them to feel like a bunch of suckers where it's like, this guy took my money and now we're begging him to talk to us. Like, I don't roll that way. I want to make sure that people are feeling like, man, this guy's letting me know what's going on. Now, two was a little bit late. Three was a little bit early. I do my best, but there'll be no, hey, we're years away. Hope we get it done one of these days. I'm busy. You're like, hey, thanks. You know, and we've all seen those Kickstarters and they give crowdfunding a bad name. But yeah, I've done a bunch, bigger, smaller. But yeah, so hopefully this one's the biggest and funnest and most people. Because, I mean, here's the thing. Honestly, as far as Kickstarter goes, I've earned it. Like, I've treated everyone who's backed me the way I've wanted to be treated, you know, if I'm a consumer. Fairly and open communication and good value for my dollar. And one of the things is we put some really aggressive lower pricing on some pretty nice original art awards on this one, so people can pick up a lot of original art for less than $100.
I was gonna say, like, I was looking at some of those earlier. I think they were like at the $60 tier, like picking like a page of original art.
Yeah, we really wanted to try to make it aggressive to get that stuff in people's hands. So I mean, like I said, there's some really amazing art you can pick up for. You know, not a whole lot of money because I try to want to make it more accessible to get more people, you know, dipping into some of those things. So I think when people buy this stuff, it's a good thing.
Yeah. And you said that you've been doing this for, you've been doing Kickstarters for 9 years.
Yeah.
Like I backed issue three and I know I mean, I got it. I, like you said, it was earlier than what you intended. If I remember correctly. Right.
Yeah. By 2 months, yeah.
And that was last year, or I guess 2 years ago now, because it was 2019. But right.
But it delivered in 2020, so yeah.
Right, right. I'm pretty sure I backed things 9 years ago that I still haven't gotten. So
yeah. And well, here's the thing. One of my secrets is we don't put these things out till they're almost done. So Lords of the Cosmos, to be blunt, the only thing that's there's two things that aren't done. We need one pinup, and the backers page we can't do till the Kickstarter is over because we got to get all your names.
Which makes sense. Right. And that actually says a lot about the I can't think of the word for it. It says a lot about the work that goes into it and kind of like how good your whole team is about actually knowing that this is going to get done. Cuz you know there are plenty of people out there that like they want to do a comic but like, you know, they can't afford to pay an artist up front to draw something. So they might run the Kickstarter and hope they get enough and then hope that the artist can actually deliver in the time frame that they promise in the Kickstarter.
So
whereas like you're
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, let's just say whereas like you just said, like you've gotten most of this already done. Like your artist trusts you that like, you know, this book is going to go on the Kickstarter, it's going to get created, it's going to get sent to people.
Well, let me just say one thing here. I pay all my artists up front out of my pocket. So the only person that's at risk here is me. So especially during COVID, and I've always
never mind everything I said.
Yeah, so I mean, like everyone that's done work on this book's been paid in full. They've all been paid. So I mean, here's the thing: I've done well enough with my art that like I have the money to do it, but I don't want to make these guys hang for. Well, you know, you're gonna have to wait for 6 months. Thanks for your work. Like they deserve to get paid, and if you're gonna ask good people to do good work, you got to pay them. So I mean, you could pull one of my books and pull names and say, hey. You know, repaid. Yeah, Jason paid me. Like,
yeah, which is awesome. I guess that probably makes it a little easier to budget when you're trying to figure out what the goal is too, because you already know exactly what you've spent and you know what you need to do the physical printing at that point.
Yep.
So
the only guy hanging out to dry if it doesn't fund is this guy. But I believe in my stuff, so to me, it's not even a risk because I know that we have the support to make our goals, and the goal is like $4,000, so it isn't some outrageous dollar amount we're trying to hit. But no, so if you want to support a project that paid working artists, support Lords of the Cosmos because all the people that worked on it got paid.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about Kickstarters is like especially backing ones from people that I know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, one guy I know, like he runs Kickstarters like crazy, mm-hmm. but like he's always on time with it. Basically, kind of like what you said up front, like he's always on time. If something's going to be late, he's out there making updates. He's out there during the campaign promoting it the whole time. And like, you know, when you get one of his books, just like with one of these books, like it's going to be quality. Like the people that worked on it are like, they're getting whatever their compensation is for it. Like,
yeah,
you know, you're supporting something that's actually like being done right. And not somebody like off on the side be like, well, I'm just going to take your money and then we're going to see if we can make something happen.
Yeah, and again, we've all read the names. Like, we don't need to badmouth anybody because it's easy to find. But there's been way too many of these crowdfundings where it's like, it's disrespectful to the teams. Where like, hey, we didn't pay the letter or colors or whatever, and you know, hey, here's this guy that gave us $100, and we told him to go piss off when he was asking where his stuff was 2 years later. There's too much of that, and it's so disrespectful towards everybody, the creators. It's disrespectful to, you know, the people that are kind enough to back these things. So, you know, here's the thing. I've done enough of these things that I think my brand, no matter what I was doing, you should say, okay, this guy is taking care of his team. Because I think we even have a thing in the Kickstarter saying these people got paid in the credits, right? Because it's, and you know, they got paid during COVID. You know, which again, times are tight. These people got paid, so that this is a project that took care of the people that did the work, and it's going to take care of the people that are going to support the book. Like, there's no ambiguity. And like I said, we need the and the credits page with all the backers' names. The art's done for that. We just need your names. You know,
yeah, which is awesome.
I would say we're 98% done. Like I said, waiting for one pin up and the credits page. That's it. It's all done.
Yeah, and like that's crazy because, like I said, like I've backed things like not just like I've backed a few comics that took especially long, but like I've backed like some games and stuff too. That yeah, like I'm going on a decade, and every once in a while they send out an update, and it's like, hey, we're still working on this. I'm like, cool. Like I kind of gave up at this point. Like it's been 10 years.
Yeah, you're never gonna get it. And look, I get it. Things happen. But the problem is that you have people doing these things that are not professional and they're not business people, and you're putting money in their hands, and I don't think they know how to handle the responsibility of managing a group of excited fans. Because part of it is too, people give money to this stuff, they want a result. So like, I don't like to do these Kickstarters without these books being almost done, because what if I collect all your money? I'm like, ooh, we better get to work. What if it takes way longer than I thought? Then I'm just like, hey, we're still working, and you're upset.
Yeah. I mean, look. Like you said before, like you've got your day job, you've got kids, like
yep,
like anything could happen, like especially right now. Like I assume your kids are probably homeschooling right now.
Well, they're going to go back to school tomorrow. School. Today they were off for Martin Luther King Day, but they are going back to in person school tomorrow. And they've been
okay, so school. So they're at in person stuff. So like I have a lot of friends with kids that like they're all remote schooling.
Well,
so
like my kids have been remote for like 3 months.
Oh, okay,
so
is tomorrow their first day back?
Yeah, so I actually got to wrap this up soon because bedtime's right around the corner. But you know,
oh yeah, no, I just realized it's actually almost 9 o'clock. But yeah, like I mean, if that book wasn't done already, like you know, anything could happen. You could have to spend the next 3 months like making sure your kids are getting their homework done when you would normally be
well
drawing.
Exactly, and here's the thing: by having the book almost done at this point, it really doesn't even matter what happens to me unless I'm like struck dead, knock on wood, right?
Yeah,
like, really. This book is like literally sitting on the finish line where like it just needs files sent to the printing company. Like that's yeah. Where it's at. So this isn't like a hope. It's like, no, it's the page files are, I mean, literally it's a pinup and then some text. And
which, I mean, that's that from somebody that doesn't produce things for a living. Like that sounds like the best way to do it. Cause then you're not left wondering about anything.
No. And like I said, you can speak with authority and say, this is what's not done yet. Boom, boom. And it's like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
And like I said, the one we can't do till the Kickstarter's over because we got to get everyone's name and then we'll have you spell check it and everything else. But I mean, that to me, that's nothing. I mean, that's nothing work. I mean, we'll just collect names and send them to Dave Sharp to letter it, and he'll put it together and we'll send out and say, please check your name, Chris, to make sure we spelled it correctly. And you'll say, yep, looks good. And we'll be like, okay, great. Yeah. Put it in press.
Yeah, exactly. And then it gets printed, and then you get to the fun part of boxing everything up and actually mailing it.
Yeah, and then sketch covers and all that. But I find that to be kind of it's fun to get all those books and everything else. But again, I try to run these things right, and really I go back to the golden rule. I just try to treat my team and the backers the way I would want to be treated if I was on the team and not the leader, or if I was, you know, a backer that like I gave you money and you said, we'll have something by, you know, July or whatever. And around July, I'll get it. Cause I get it. Things happen. Maybe it's August or September. Just let me know. Don't have me chasing and saying, hey, where's my stuff? Don't bug me. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you updated once a month, I don't know how frequently the updates were, but like, you know, even if you're just one of those guys that are like once a month, you're like, book's coming along, it's at the printers, see you next month. Like, well, you're letting people know what's going on.
The one thing about Kickstarter is this: it's like a permanent record. Like, I could tell you, well, I didn't have problems. You can look at my comments. You can go look on my comments, and it, you know, I think on issue two there was a person said, "Hey, we need an update," and I wrote this prodigious update apologizing because I had kind of gotten sucked into some printing issues and I was trying to figure it out and I wasn't communicating. I think that's the only time I ever had anyone even, and that was just saying, "Hey, what's going on?" Not like, "Where's my stuff?" You know, negative comment after negative comment. Because you can go look and say, "Well, Jason said, okay, so look at issue three. Go back and look at the updates." You can go back and look, and you'll say, "Oh yeah, there was pretty regular updates near the end." So I mean, like, you could go back and say, "We're going to fact check you, Jason. Is that what you really did?" Well, you can go look, and you'll see that there was many updates.
Yeah, and you do the thing that I'm sure it annoys some people to get the emails, but you do the thing that I like Kickstarter creators doing. Like, you go back to your other Kickstarters and you keep updating them as you're running new campaigns.
Like, what I try to do is kind of, I have a natural transition out. So with issue three, I updated the people on issue two for like the first half, and then I was like, you know what I mean? Because so then, like, I may go back and do one mention of the fourth issue. I've done two, and I'll probably do three for a couple updates, and then cut it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because if somebody backed issue two but skipped issue three, they're probably not backing issue four. But at least you're giving them that little like nudge. Be like, "Hey, maybe you weren't able to back us at the time, but you know, for you know $30, I think it was, or somewhere around there, like you can just get all four issues."
Yeah, so I mean, and you're right, but I'm not going to put too much into the issue to people because hopefully a lot of them came along for the, and a lot of them did, but maybe someone just checked out and said, "I don't like this." And okay, but I mean, I don't want to bombard them. So I mean, I try to limit it to what makes sense and not like hit them up like it's like, okay, you're hitting me up with too much. I mean, there is a level of enough, not enough, and too much. They're all, like, you want to be right in the, you know, not too hot, not too cold. Like, if it's, "I'm bothering you every single day," that's too much. But on the other hand, there's things where it's like, "I gave you money. I need an update. You know, we need to hear from you." That's too, not
yeah,
enough.
And like, exactly. And like, I don't need like a weekly update on like a comic, but you know, knowing that if I just happen to miss issue three for some reason, that when issue four comes out, I'll see those updates for issue two. Be like, "Oh, cool. Four's out. I can back that," even if it's just that one time, just to let people know, like, issue four's Kickstarter is live.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah. So before we start wrapping up, yep. Any last things you want to say about issue four, the Kickstarter?
The video kicks ass. We put a lot of work into that.
It is a really cool video.
I'm really proud of the video. I'm really proud of the Kickstarter. They're kind of like doing big term papers, and I always try with everyone to do more proofreading, more graphics. And my friend from California, Ariel Celestino, who does a book called Mecha Organic, he did all of our marketing graphics. The graphics, I think, are the best we've ever had. The video is the best we've ever had. The art is just stellar. I think the Kickstarter just looks freaking awesome. I've gotten better at making them. I'm really proud of it. I kind of feel like a kid at the science fair. Like, I want everyone to come see my plants, you know, that I grew with different soils. Like, I'm really excited for people to actually see the Kickstarter because we put so much work into it. I'm just excited. So, I mean, if you're listening to this, I just hope you check it out. And look, even if you're like, "This isn't for me," I just want you to give it a shot and look at it, because I think there's a tremendous amount of work in the book. But even the Kickstarter, there's a lot of work. And like, you know, Chris, you're getting to look at it. So I think it's a pretty damn good Kickstarter for a comic book.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. Like, I look at a lot of Kickstarters, and you can tell the difference between the people that just kind of like threw it together with what they had and a little bit of information, and the people that actually like took the time, got key art done specifically for the Kickstarter, had people proofreading it, like making sure that it was what it was. And also just the backer tiers are always super important, and you kind of run the gamut with them. Like, for as little as $8, you can get all four issues digital. Like,
yeah.
I mean, and that's the early bird, so that's limited. But just the where did it go? I just had it here. It's $15. You get all four issues digitally. That's cheaper than a comic on a shelf.
we try to make comics for $15 for a comic now? What?
That's no, I meant for four issues.
Oh, okay. I was like, holy crap, am I really missing out? But no,
we tried, some of them are $15.
We tried to make it so that if you only had a couple bucks, you could get in the game. I like to have a variety of tiers. So if someone's like, I got money, I want to buy some stuff. It's like, cool, we got you too. Now, I will say this. I mentioned Kickstarter has this new pre-launch notice function. They also have now, this is the first time I'll have add-ons, because I wasn't doing ones big enough for like backer kit, but now Kickstarter is offering that for smaller guys like me to do. So you'll be
Cool.
So now this is the first time you'll be able to say, can I add a t-shirt or a book or a sticker or whatever, right? You can add stuff. So Kickstarter's done a good job. So this is, again, the first time that I've gotten the pre-launch option. This is the first time I'll have add-ons. So that's exciting too. So again, hope everyone checks it out. This has been a great conversation. Hopefully, if you've listened for this long, for 2 hours and 8 minutes, like hopefully you're like, oh, you didn't quite sell me on it. If we didn't do it by this point, I guess we failed, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, and it's worth checking out the Kickstarter. Just you can give it a look. You can see what the art looks like. You can see if it's up your alley or not. Like I said, the link for the Kickstarter will be in the description on whatever podcast app you may use. And you can click on that ahead of time. It'll bring you to like the pre-register page or whatever Kickstarter calls that, where you can click on it and it'll send you a reminder on Saturday when it goes live.
That link, if you just clicked on that link in 2 weeks, it will take you to the Kickstarter. So they've gotten smarter at Kickstarter. So like that link is now like the link that is the pre-launch link, but once the thing launches, that's the link. So like that link is, I've done it long enough. Like I give them credit as a company. They've done a better job improving over the years, because it used to be like, well, I'll have one, you know, and like, okay,
yeah,
you know, what's the link?
Exactly.
Well, we'll find out the day I launch it, you know.
Yeah. Which makes it much harder for you to prepare ahead of time for like posts to go live and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, like they've done a better job helping people like me do a better job to promote, to get that, you know, swell of interest moving, and you know, and part of it's having a proper goal, you know, what you can actually get, and preparing to have the right amount of people, and you know, understanding who your fan, you know, what level of support you enjoy, and you know, and to appropriately plan and execute it. But no, it'll be a good campaign. I enjoy doing all these interviews. It gives me a good chance to talk to some of my geeky friends that I don't get to see.
Yeah, especially with this year. Yep. So I've got one last quick question for you that's actually not related to the Kickstarter.
Go for it.
You mentioned anime earlier.
Yes.
What anime are you watching, or trying to watch at least?
Well, on April 24th, I rented the State Theater in State College, and a handful of my friends and I will be going to watch a private screening of Akira.
Oh, that's really cool.
So, yeah, Akira is, what, 12, 33 years old? I still think, hands down, it's the best anime ever made. But anime I'm watching right now, besides this Akira theater experience that I'm geeking out over, it's like a 500-person theater with like 12 of us, I think.
That's really cool.
What anime am I watching right now? I'm getting geeked up to watch the new Blu-ray re-release of Megazone 3, and my kids and I are trying to watch the very first season of Bastard on Blu-ray. No, not Bastard. Berserk. I'm sorry. Bastard's
in okay. Blu-ray. I was going to say, Bastard seems different for kids, but...
Well, Berserk's still not necessarily the most kid friendly, but the kids wanted to watch it, so I was like, "Yeah, we'll give it a watch." But we actually, the last anime series that I really got into was with my kids, was Dorohedoro on Netflix, which I thought was really good. I have the manga, and I thought they did a really good job of adapting that book to the animated thing, and my kids liked it. It was kind of it's violent, but it was kind of kids fun violent. If that, I sound like a terrible parent.
Okay. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Look, man, I grew up watching Nightmare on Elm Street movies when I was like 6.
Yeah,
and I turned out fine.
Yeah, so yeah, I think Dorohedoro was the most recent one I've watched, and
so you're more like an old school, like you like going back and watching like the 80s and 90s stuff.
Yeah, I think my favorite era of anime was probably from like 87 to about 95. So, and right now it's a weird time period because a lot of releases from those years are being re-released. Like, so Midnight Aigoku is one of my favorite weird VA titles, and that was out of print forever. And then like last year I was like, hey, it's on Blu-ray. And I was like, what? So I bought it. And it's just 2 40-minute episodes. It's just weird. But I really like Midnight Aigoku.
Yeah, back in like the early 2000s, I got really into like the weird stuff, because it was the fan sub era. So like you could go on to like those different programs and like download a bunch of just AVI files of like weird ass shows that somebody just subbed in their basement.
Mm-hmm.
So since then, like I'm very generic. I watch a lot of shonen stuff. Mm-hmm. So like my wife and I are we're watching through Inuyasha because she's never seen it, and through Yu Yu Hakusho.
So I was really geeked up for Yamato 2199, which I thought was an amazing OVA, and then Yamato 2202 came out, and like, oh, it's bad, and I'm just like, what? Come on. And like, that's a series from the 70s that they gave an overall, you know, some member berries, but the first season was amazing. The old show was so clunky and old that it actually merited a kind of a refresh. And the first season was like better than the original show. I thought it was so good. But then like the second season, I was just like, it's hard to watch. And I'm just like, what? So yeah, no.
Yeah.
If you ever want to get me on a show talking about anime, I love to sit and like really get into it. I have a stack of anime to watch. I need to watch the Blu-ray re-release of Angel Cop. What is that one that got big on Netflix where there's that girl with the outfit where she has like two eyes on her chest and the big ass sword? And it's like a sports academy.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah, it was really popular like 3 years ago. I got a Chinese DVD of that I gotta watch because I think it's still on Netflix. I can't think of the name. Shoot, she has like a big red sword.
I know it. I've never seen it, but I've like seen like it on Netflix. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Kill the Kill,
that one. Yeah,
yeah. And then
apparently that's super popular.
Yeah, that got really popular. And you know what else I gotta watch is Parasite. That's a great book, like a manga. And oh, okay, the last. After the most recent anime my kids and I watched was season 2 of Attack on Titan, and we just got season 3 for Christmas, so we got that.
Oh, nice.
We got Attack on Titan.
Season 4, the final season, is actually airing right now. Once that finishes, I'm gonna watch it. I haven't watched any of it.
I've been collecting the manga, and I'm on volume 25 at this point. It's such a complicated book, and I've been reading it slowly over years that I'm like, wait, what? Sometimes I take so long between volumes. I'm like, wait, what happened to the one I read before 6 months ago?
Yeah, we live in this cool era now where so much of this stuff is just available like on streaming services. Like, it's almost like a spoil of riches. You don't even know what to start with.
Well, I'm talking the books, like the actual paper books. Where I'm like, because I have volume 25 on my to read shelf, and I'm like, wait, what happened in 24? Oh, wow.
Well, even the manga, I think Attack on Titan is actually, I think it's available just on the Shonen Jump app. Like.
Yeah, I still read them on paper. I never read anime or manga on an app. I just buy the books, and I have a gigantic series of shelves with like hundreds of them on the shelves.
I used to buy a lot of the physical books, even comics. I've transitioned a lot to digital. I ran out of space.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's eventually going to be a problem for me, but I still got enough space yet that I keep getting books. Not as much. Yeah, I still get as many books as I used to.
Yeah, which I mean that helps. I've taken very much to like if I can pay a small fee and just read as much as I want, I'm all for that.
and I think that's becoming more and more people. I think I'm in this stupid old head minority. I think that's where I'm at. My brain.
If I had the space though, I would just have rooms full of like books, comics, manga, like Blu-rays. I have too many Blu-rays to begin with. I just keep buying physical movies.
So can I tell you my big toy purchase for the year? And I'm not going to say how much it costs in case my wife listens to this for two and a half hours or whatever. Bandai is re-releasing the 2010 1/6 scale model red motorcycle from Akira.
I saw that.
Yeah, I pre-ordered one. It's nice. It's 20 inches long and weighs like 7 pounds. And
man,
you can tie it into your home theater and like press the gas and brakes and the bike, and it runs sound effects through your home theater. The thing lights up.
That's really cool.
Yeah, no. And then there's a Kaneda figure that's scaled to fit it, which is also obscenely expensive. And I don't buy many toys, but I'm like, okay, okay, uncle, you got me. I'm buying your bike.
You're the guy who rented out a movie theater to go watch that movie with his friends. Like, I feel like you need the bike.
Yeah, at this point, I would probably be charged criminally. It's like, you did that? No, yeah, it's funny. Well, our local theater, the State Theater, is renting out the theater for a couple hundred bucks for like private showing. So We rented it to watch Heavy Metal, the movie, in December, and then that got shut down by the governor, and then that got rescheduled to February, and then they had to reschedule that for their big fundraiser event, so then we had to push our Heavy Metal viewing till March, till my birthday.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, look, as a favor for, like, moving your date so much, they're like, we're going to give you a free night. Is there a movie you want to watch? I'm like, yeah, Akira, in April 24th, 7 o'clock. And they're like, it's on the house for us because you bought the other night. I'm like, sweet.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a deal. Like, it sucks it got pushed back so many times, but you definitely made out on that one in the long run.
The State Theater is amazing. So we're going to have Heavy Metal night for my birthday in March, and then we're going to have Akira night in April. And I think each one's only going to have like 12 to 15 people in this old time opera kind of theater for like 530 people.
That's awesome.
And they'll show them on Blu-ray. So it's going to be like a Blu-ray big screen with like nobody there. So no talking, no people being annoying. It's just me and my friends.
Yeah, and like if your friends say something, it's going to be part of the movie. Like they're going to cheer with you at the right part and exactly. Laugh at the right part.
Exactly. So yes, I'm the guy with the Akira movie night at a real theater, which is amazing. So yes, I have to buy the bike or else I'm in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's probably a good place to wrap up, because like you said, you have to go start getting the kids ready for bed.
Bedtime.
Where can people find you outside of the Kickstarter, obviously?
So you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Lennox Artist, LennoxArtist. On Etsy, I am Lennox Art Emporium. And on Facebook, I am Jason Lennox Illustrator on Facebook. So it's like facebook.com/Jason Lennox Illustrator. And then my big website that I put art updates on, like a big archive for the last decade, is jasonlennox.com. But I'm pretty easy to find. Just look up at Lennox Artist, and you know, when the Kickstarter goes live, it'll be on all my social medias pinned to the top. So you'll be able to find it really easily, either through the podcast links here, through my stuff. So I'll be easy to find. Just at Lennox Artist, JasonLennox.com. Easy. Or Lords of the Cosmos. Just Google Lords of the Cosmos for Kickstarter. You'll find us. Everyone can use Google these days, right, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, look, that my entire job revolves around using Google. So
yeah.
But yeah, and I'll throw all the social links and stuff into the show notes too, just so people can find you. And if you'd like to find more stuff from OneQuest, you can head over to www.one-quest.com. You can also help us out by supporting us at patreon.com/OneQuest. If you can't support us there with dollars, you can support us by going to your favorite podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, all those fun things. Rate us, review us, subscribe to us. All those things help a whole bunch. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/OneQuest online or @one_quest on Instagram and Twitter. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/OneQuestVideo, and you can send us emails to social@one-quest.com. Anyway, Jason, thank you again for being here.
Chris, thanks
good
for
luck.
Having me.
Good luck on Saturday. Hopefully we can get you a big opening day boost.
Fingers crossed.
And we'll be back next time with something else.
Thanks so much, buddy. Back to the kind of the show aspect of it. I mean, I think one of the things I've learned, and Chris, I'm curious, you know, what you guys have seen is virtual shows. I don't think work at all. I tried two and I was staggered by how poorly they went as far as like making a dollar. And I think some things have translated well to Zoom. Like if you have a focused work meeting for half an hour with people with a purpose, I think that works. But just to say, hey, come on down, I do not think that works.
No, it really doesn't. And I think the only real virtual convention that like I really checked out was Crunchyroll, like the streaming platform did one. It was links to people's like Etsy shops and DeviantArt and stuff like that. You know, you couldn't really get like a feel for like what their stuff was based off of just like a JPEG.
No.
Whereas like a lot of times, like at least for me personally, like when I go to like conventions, when like I can go to them, it's, you know, walking up and down Artist Alley and like looking at the people that are doing the work. Like usually like at your tables, like either you or somebody that's there with you is trying to engage with people. Like you might be busy, like actually like working, like, you know, like drawing stuff. But like, you have somebody else there that if somebody walks by and like glances your way, like they're talking to them, they're trying to engage with them, trying to see what it is they're looking for. And that's always been kind of how I pick stuff up. Like the guy who's just kind of sitting there and seems like he doesn't want to be bothered with people isn't the one that I'm necessarily going to spend the time to like read their books and like get to know like what their actual artwork is.
Yeah, it's, you know, like I said, and especially you being in IT, I think Zoom is an incredible app. I think it's an incredible application. I will praise it for what it does well. The online experience for certain things does work. It's going to work for this. Like, this is great. We can record at home. This is a wonderful app, Zencastr.
Yeah, especially like I you're actually not that far from me. I think you're out in like State College area,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm right over the Waltman Bridge in Jersey. So like we're like a 2-hour drive from each other. But if you were in California, we could still be doing this.
Right. But again, for things like concerts, I know Behemoth, who's a band that I like, tried to do a virtual concert. I didn't pay for it. I was like, I'm not going to do this. I mean, it just seemed like without actually going to see someone live to pay to watch a video stream of them playing, it just didn't connect with me. I was like, yeah. I could go watch them on YouTube or buy a Blu-ray. It just seemed odd to me. And, you know, I don't think concerts translate to people paying for it to go.
Exactly.
It just doesn't work, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Like there's some, like a concert isn't just the music itself. It's the atmosphere. It's the crowd. It's the energy.
Correct.
Like, if I'm going to pay somebody to listen to music, I'm just going to like listen to it on Spotify or whatever streaming app I use. Like, well, it's probably going to be a better quality audio at that point.
Well, and here's the thing is for a live show, I mean, just go to YouTube and type in a band. There's a million, like, here's them at a club, yeah. Here's them at a show. So it's like, why would I pay for this? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense where it's like, I have no problem paying to go to a concert, but I would not pay to watch them stream a show.
Yeah, exactly. And I know a few places were doing, they were like pre-recording them too and then streaming them. I forget what band I saw did that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like they recorded it like a month prior. And then so at that point, like it was like you said, it was like almost like a DVD of their concert. It's like, well, I'll just go find an old DVD of the concert then.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, obviously, one of the things we're going to talk about is this Kickstarter that I'll be up to in a couple days. I think Kickstarter has gone through the roof because that does work well online versus we stripped away the show, the Artist Alley, for the foreseeable future. So I think people that are doing crowdfunding right now are doing very well because the geeky population, whatever you want to call those people that do that stuff, they still have an interest and they still want to spend their money on something. And crowdfunding and putting books out to say, hey, I'm trying to make something, I think that translates very well. And I was thinking that crowdfunding would be really hurt through COVID, but everything that I've seen and read and my friends that have done Kickstarters recently during the COVID lockdowns has said it's gone great just because people are stuck, they're at home, computers still work. So they can have that.
And they have, I mean, like not everybody has extra funds right now. Cause like there are,
correct.
Unfortunately, there are plenty of people that lost work, lost jobs because of everything. But like in a lot of cases, like the people that are still able to work, like they have that money that they're not spending because they're not going to shows. So it's
right.
Like, oh, cool. This person's doing a Kickstarter. I'll just throw them the money I would have spent on like buying the book when I saw them at, you know, New York Comic Con or something like that.
And let me just rewind a second. I mean, I got to check what I said there. I mean, you're right. Some people have been, it's very feast and famine. Some people have been hurt really bad. Other people have done well. In the construction trades, like construction stuff is through the roof. Right?
Yeah, I've noticed.
So, I mean, if you're selling like sports tickets and vacation, or you're like a service person, like a bartender, you're getting crushed. So, I mean, I shouldn't say that everyone's got money to spend, because you're right. Some people don't through no fault of their own, but there's still people that, like you said, that like, hey, I'm still working. Maybe I'm actually doing really well, but like we're saying, but they're just like, I can't go to New York Comic Con. I can't go to, you know, C2E2. And they just are like, I still have my interests and I want to spend on something, you know?
Yeah, so some people have that money put aside already. Like some people are like, you know, last year for income tax season, like in February, you know, they take their tax return, they put it in their savings account. They're like, this is my money for conventions for the year. And then conventions all got canceled. So like they might still just have that savings sitting there and they're waiting for that stuff to be available for them to kind of, you know, get that get that stuff again.
Right. No, and it's just, to your point, I think those conventions were, they were almost like big political stumps, but every artist and creator is their own party saying, come vote for me with, you know, your feet and your dollars and your interest. And I think there was a lot of, I mean, thousands, if not tens of thousands, depending on the size of the event, micro relationships being built with creators and fans together to say, you know, it's you're out stumping for office, basically saying, check out my project, check out my book. And we've removed that organic growth where you could just go and meet the people. And I think that's definitely, it sucks. It sucks because you miss that churn. You miss meeting all those new people, and it really sucks.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, even like for like your book that, so we're going to kind of stop for a second. I'll do an intro and then I'll splice all this together after the fact.
I love it.
But just to finish this thought, like with your book, there's only so much that like text on a Kickstarter can really convey. Whereas you being at a show, standing there with, you know, the first three issues available and being able to pick that book up to somebody who just like happened to glance at it, like in passing, and like flip through the thing, give them like a rundown of the story, show them like the passion you have for it and what it's all about. Like, that's how you get somebody interested in it.
That, and I think part of it is like, so someone kind of stumbles into you and they ask a question, what's this about? I think you can make a sale if you're like, hey, thanks for asking, and you're positive, you engage them, you look at them, you make them feel important, you express your positivity. Whereas on the flip side, if you're like, what? You know what I mean? And like, what do you want? You know, and then it's like, oh my God, like, and you know, are you rude? Are you pleasant? Do you make a sour face? Do you engage? You know, all that's gone, you know, and now it's just text.
Yeah, and like, you know, I don't know how often, like when you're at shows, you get a chance to actually like walk around. But like, that's basically all I'm there to do is walk around and like look at things, talk to people. And like, I've hit the whole gamut of people where like I've walked up to like bigger names. I'm not going to say any names but like I've walked up to like bigger names that like were just chilling at their table kind of by themselves, like drawing or something like that. And like, just tried to like have like a short conversation because I like their work, and like basically get not ignored, but like treated like I'm a nuisance to them being able to enjoy themselves.
Sure.
And then there's other people that I've gone up to and done the same thing that are, you know, big names that like you see all over like the big two books that are super excited to have somebody come up and talk about the stuff they worked on. And like the same thing happens with like the smaller creators. Some of them like you and a bunch of other guys I know are like you're all about it. Like you want to tell people about the stuff you're doing, and other people are just like, I just want to sit here and draw. Like if you want to buy something, cool, but like I don't really want to talk. I just want to draw.
Yeah, and I think it goes to two things. One, what is their personality, right? Are they introverts? Yeah. Are they extroverts? Are they positive? Are they negative? You know, etc. And then I think the second part is having an understanding of business, in that it's cool if you're famous and there's a lot of things going your way. But when you're really kind of negative and sour to those, you know, people that stumble into you, you have no idea who these people are. You don't know who they know. You don't know how much they're going to spend in the next 5 to 10 years. Like, are they going to be promoting your stuff? So it's like when someone stumbles into you and says, hey, what are you doing? Like the business person in me says, it doesn't pay to be rude. It always pays to be positive. Now, at some point, if someone's just dogging you and harassing you, I mean, you might want to say, hey, could you go?
But yeah, and that's a different case.
Yeah, but for people to come up to you at what essentially is a marketing networking event and engage with you, if you're going to be surly to the person that asks you what you're up to, why are you there? You know what I mean? Like, go home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like there was, I was at a Baltimore Comic Con like 9 years ago now. It was like 2011, 2012. It was right after like the New 52 happened, and Batman was huge at the time with Snyder and Capullo, and they were at Baltimore Comic Con, and they had a huge line for signatures, and Capullo actually had like a limited sketch for the show. Mm-hmm. So like my wife and I, we were waiting in line for him, and the line. But I think I saw you at Baltimore once, I believe, right?
Yeah, like I've definitely talked to you and your wife at Baltimore at least once.
I thought it was Baltimore because I know the first time that I met you was in Philly at Keystone. But I thought Baltimore was one of the other ones.
Yep, that's where it was.
But yeah, Baltimore that year did a very bad job with lines and basically blocked a bunch of people's tables by like the way they ran the line for them. Mm-hmm. And I happened to just be standing in front of this one table for like an hour and like struck up conversation with the guys that were working it, selling their book. And like, I've been friends with the one dude ever since. Like, it's going on like 9 years now where like, I see him at shows all the time, like chat with him on Facebook occasionally. Like he will see me like down the hall when I walk into an artist alley and like, he'll like wave me over and stuff.
Yeah. And I think that's
all just because like, I happen to be standing by his table and he was personable.
Yeah, there's a magic to conventions where if you do them long enough or you attend them long enough and you build those relationships with the exhibitors and the attendees and the networking of people there, that there is a certain sense of it's almost like a camp, like a multi-day camp and or a pleasant family reunion where it's like you're excited to see, you know.
Do those exist, though?
Family reunions, not anymore. But that's the feel that I got after doing them for enough years, that there was definitely a friendly feel, that the people, you'd go to a town and each show has its circuit where these are the people that go to these shows because it's geographically, you know, close to their house or there's a positive memory. And then each show as an exhibitor has a different flavor based on the people, and you never know. I mean, every year you could always meet amazing new friends and make new relationships with people that you never met before. And there's always a certain excitement to that. That you know, yeah. I'm a social machine. I love people, so like I always enjoy meeting new people and engaging with people. And I enjoy. I always call it holding court. You have your little space, and you're kind of sitting there and promoting yourself. And obviously, you've put a lot of work into the stuff you've made, so you're kind of proud to show it off, and it's fun to get that, you know, immediate in-person engagement.
Yeah, and it's always good when you are, like, a people person for that sort of thing, too, because having, like, one or two people standing at your table while you're just, like, chatting with them, like, you might not even really be doing anything in particular. You might just be having a conversation. It ends up getting other people to want to come over and be like, why are those people just standing there? Like, what's going on?
Right. What's happening? What is so interesting that that guy wants to go look at? Why is Chris staring at that? You know, what does he see?
Yeah, exactly. And then like you end up getting like little crowds around your table sometimes as you're, you know, maybe explaining your book or pitching something or selling a print to somebody. Like it just gets more people interested. You get to know more people. And like you said, it's like a marketing event.
Yeah. And, you know, and now right now, kind of getting ready for this Kickstarter to launch, like I'm in kind of, and I literally feel like a politician because you have your basic pitch and then you're kind of like blanketing these online areas with like, here's my pitch, here's my pitch, here's my pitch, here's my pitch. And it's kind of a very repetitive mode. I know it'll get annoying. I'll get annoyed with it very soon, but it's just a different mode.
Yeah, and it's funny how there's two types of people with Kickstarters I've noticed. There's people, and it's, I mean, it's been almost what? It's been just over a year since issue 3's Kickstarter, right?
Yep, a little bit over a year.
So I honestly don't remember that campaign all that well at this point, but there's people, and it sounds like you're one of these people where, like, you're on top of it. Like, you're letting people know on social media, like, Kickstarter's running, here's where we're at right now, here's where our goal's out, here's, like, let's try and get to, like, this next milestone.
Right.
And then there's the people that are just kind of like, I feel bad asking you for money. So like, if you could just check this out when you have time, and like, maybe they post about it like once or twice, like every other day or so, just enough to keep it in people's minds and get like the people to back it. But like, they're not out there, like you said, like campaigning for it the way like you'd campaign for office.
Well, here's the thing. I've been in commercial and industrial sales and management now for 24 years. So you'll teach new people in that world, ask for the sale. I will take people's money at work at will. So, you know, to me, if you talk to people that are like sheltered creatives that don't sell, asking for money to them feels almost like dirty. Like, Chris, can I have money? Like, they feel bad asking for it. But, you know, you teach, you know, young sales, you know, salespeople, you know, out of the chute, one of the first things you'll teach a 22-year-old out of school or even younger is ask for the sale, take the check, get the contract signed, get it, and get over that feeling of feeling guilty or bad, because if you don't like it, get out of the game. So like,
yeah, exactly.
So like all day, every day, I'm selling stuff. All day. So this Kickstarter, all to me, is just shifting gears into selling something different. Where, you know, so I forget, I was talking to someone recently and they mentioned something to me and I dropped the Kickstarter just in conversation and they said, dude, you are nonstop. You always are trying to move something around. And I'm like, yeah, I can't help it. I'm like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's in your DNA.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be like having a dog and say, this dog barks and chases balls all the time. It's like, that's what they do. Like, that's, if you didn't want that, get a cat.
Yeah, exactly.